Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's conference. With that, I'll turn the call over to Tom Cruchot. Tom, please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Transmission Access Charge Options, or affectionately known as TAC Options, working group meeting here today. I'm going to be facilitating not only the web service, but here in the room. We'll be taking Q&A throughout the presentations today. A working group session is a little looser than our typical stakeholder meetings, so we do anticipate a lot of dialogue back and forth, not only among the presenters, but the audience. And so we're going to ask that if you do chime in and make a comment, please give your name and the company that you represent for the folks on the phone. We're probably going to have three or four times the number of folks on the phone than we have here in the room, and sometimes it's hard for them to follow along if they don't know who's speaking. So if you could just remember from time to time, or as we go to Q&A, I'll also remind you. If anyone here in the room is needing assistance, please let me know, and same thing for the folks on the phone. Also, with our different initiatives, we talk in acronyms. There's SLAs, FLAs, there are TLAs, FLAs, SLAs, or two or three-letter acronyms, four or five-letter acronyms, or six or seven-letter acronyms. So if we do get into those different acronyms and you don't know what they are, send me a chat. I'll let you know. And I'll try to send those out to you for the folks on the phone from time to time. I know we had a lot of questions yesterday with some of the acronyms that came up, and I'm here to assist. We do have a full agenda, anticipate going to 4 o'clock today. We are looking at taking a lunch break around 12:30 to about 1:15. And again, that's loose, but we'll try to get you down into the cafeteria before it's too late, and we want to make sure that you have ample time to get your food and back to the room so we can pick up on time. But we'll give you an update as we go. Lorenzo Christoph and Neil Millar are going to be taking us through the default cost allocation for regional transmission projects, and also Lorenzo will be taking us through the region-wide rate for exports. And again, I'm pitch hitting for Christina Osborne. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Lorenzo Christoph.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks all for coming today, or for dialing in, whichever you're doing. I wanted to say a little bit before I get into substance just about what we're doing here process-wise. Because, you know, working group is not the same as our normal stakeholder process. You don't see that little diagram with the little stages on a we are here arrow. But the last time we had a meeting on this topic, which was now June 1st in Portland 2 months ago, at that time we were still contemplating possibly taking this to the board at the end of August, ridiculous as that sounds now. And since then, the schedule has shifted. We're not going to the August board, probably not even to the October board. We're going to take more time and probably spend a good part of the rest of this year working on this proposal and addressing it in its full joyful complexity. So what we wanted to do today is not rush into another full ISO proposal that covers every aspect, but rather focus on two topics that many of you in your comments said were really important and that raised a lot of legitimate concerns, and spend some time on those two topics throwing around ideas. And the ideas that you'll hear, we may accidentally use the proposal once or twice, but really we intend them as, here's an indication of what we're leaning towards because this seems to make sense. But it's very much in the spirit of wanting you to respond to it and say, if you think something else is a better idea or you want to understand the logic of how we're thinking about it, it's that kind of a discussion. And so when we ask for written comments eventually, which is about 2 weeks after today, we'd like them to be focused on these two particular topics, recognizing that sometime after that, and we haven't set a date yet, probably a couple of weeks after those comments come in or mid-September, something like that, we would be coming out with a more complete proposal that addresses these topics as well as other things. Now, one of the things you'll also see here is that some of the assumptions that we make go to other aspects of the proposal, and you'll see that right off the bat as we start talking about the default cost allocation. So For example, back in one of the earlier proposals, as we were looking at methods for figuring out what are the benefits of a project, we were talking about using a DFACS methodology that PJM uses, and it's based on looking at snapshot power flows. Well, we're not really thinking about doing that anymore. So, and yet we haven't come out with a formal proposal that says that's off the table. But for today's assumption, let's assume that that's not on the table. If somebody really loves it and wants to see it back, by all means, we'll listen to that. You know, but we didn't see a lot of acclaim for it in the past. So we'll be doing a few of those kinds of things. I'll try to point them out when we get. You know, these are elements that are not exactly part of what we're talking about today, but we kind of need to make some assumptions in order to have a coherent discussion today. You'll see some of that kind of thing. But the basic spirit of all of it is this is open for discussion. We want to get the best ideas out, and then we will, beyond that, get to a complete next round proposal. So that's the concept. So the first topic is default cost allocation, and the afternoon will be regarding a region-wide export charge, export tax charge that we'll talk about. So here, a lot of words, but the basic concept is, and this goes back to the meeting we had in June as well, at that time we introduced the concept of what we call a body of state regulators that was going to have some role that was not really well specified in determining or at least recommending which transmission projects to build and how the costs should be allocated. And we focused the June 1st discussion almost entirely on the role of that body, even though we didn't know much about it, but the concept of having such a body rather than ISO making decisions just pointed out the simple fact that FERC Order 1000 does require the ISO to have default provisions for cost allocation. And many parties said, well, tell us what those are, because that's really more important. This body of state regulators, now I think renamed the Western States Committee under our governance concept proposal, we don't know what this thing is going to look like. We don't know who's going to be on it. We don't know what its responsibilities is, whether it'll have authority of any kind or decision making. All that's an unknown. But we do know that the ISO has to have default provisions in the tariff. So let's talk about that. And so that's why this topic here today. And to put that in perspective, the default provisions in the tariff are ones that will enable us to march through a transmission planning process. In that process, identify transmission additions and upgrades that pass our criteria for something that's needed and beneficial, and that because we'll have default cost allocation, we'll also have a cost allocation to subregions specified as part of the planning process following those provisions. I say cost allocation to subregions because within subregions, there are individual PTOs and other entities, and we're not at this point going to that level. It's really just the idea of the major subregions, which under the proposal is the new PTO would be like PacifiCorps, that's the entity who's in the dialogue right now, would be its own subregion, and the current CAISO footprint would also be a subregion. So it's that inter-subregion cost allocation we're talking about. So with that idea, then we go back to the definition of new facilities. This is a simplification, I think, of what you saw on June 1st, again following suggestions that several of you made in comments. Simply define new facilities as transmission facilities, which could be additions or upgrades, planned and approved through an expanded transmission planning process conducted by the ISO for the expanded BAA. As we've said in the past, that new process would really start at the time that the new PTO is integrated. So if, say, the date were to be January 1st, 2020, when PacifiCorps officially becomes part of the ISO and we start operating as an expanded balancing authority area, then it would be the transmission planning process that starts in January 2020 would be the first instance of this expanded process. New facility will be considered for regional cost allocation if it's rated greater than or equal to 200 kV. One comment about that is really everything we're talking about in this entire day and through our proposal has been about 200 kV and above facilities. We have the distinction under current ISO rules that facilities below 200 kV are considered local and are allocated to the specific CEO to whose system they connected or who built the facilities. If they're above 200 kV, they're collected on a regional rate. So the whole topic is really about regional cost allocation, so it's facilities above 200. Yes, Eric.
This is Eric Menzel, PG&E. I had a couple of questions. Earlier, you said that this presentation is dealing with allocations to subregions and doesn't go any deeper.
Yes.
Is there an intent by the ISO to change cost allocations within a subregion for these kind of projects?
Not really, no. Actually, at this point, the way we've been thinking about this, we don't see a reason why the inter-subregional allocation needs to change. So we're not really considering that.
So that would stay at a load ratio share then?
Well, whatever the rules are today as to how it works.
Okay.
Okay.
And then
yes.
The second question was, you're talking about the 200 kV level or filter that you're using for this presentation.
Yes.
In the previous straw proposal and in comments, there was discussion about changing those filters. Is this an indication of what your version 3's proposal is going to have,
meaning
you're a fixed?
Sort of anticipating where I was going to go. This 200, this second bullet is really a simplification of what we've had before, which had these other criteria that said it has to interconnect two subregions or something, or be an intertie to an adjoining balancing authority area. And you know, in this discussion, we're putting this out as a hypothesis, but also thinking about going in that direction. In other words, many parties made the point that the potential to have benefits accruing to different subregions from a project is not strictly tied to the category of that project. And so, therefore, if it's above 200 kV and it's approved through the new process, well, then maybe it makes sense to assess, examine the benefits, sub-regional benefits that could accrue from that process. So, for now, let's think about being on a track towards this more simplified filter.
So,
okay, go ahead, Lynette, and then Paul.
Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. I'm aware that there's another perhaps stakeholder process dealing with network upgrades made to connect generators at low voltage,
mm-hmm.
and the proposal would be to include that as a regional cost element.
Mm-hmm.
So is that an exception to your bullet here of the rating of greater than 200?
Well, In spite of my adversity to looking at things in silos and not making the interconnections between them, I'm kind of at the point right now where I have to keep that in a silo. And I don't know, basically, what the answer to that is. I don't know how it's going to be treated right now. That was driven by a specific concern. We have a proposal out there that I think makes some sense how that would play in an expanded BAA and how we would do that. I don't think we about Neil, if you can perhaps add to that.
Sure, it's Neil here for the ISO. I could probably just add that other discussion was dealing with what we saw as being a very narrowly focused issue. The terminology we were using there was today's terminology as opposed to the discussions of post-expansion. So when we started the discussion talking about the ISO as a region, we meant high voltage charges in the context as it exists today. And the question did come up about how would that relate to this initiative, and our answer there was we don't know. We see a smaller, more focused issue we need to deal with, and if that moves forward, if there's some adjustment moving forward, where that leads would need to be taken into account at some point in this process. But right now, we're not sure that anything will happen on that front, so we're keeping them delinked.
Paul, you wanted to?
Yeah, Paul Nelson. Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. So you had, in the prior graph, you had just a definition for new facilities and existing facilities. So with this definition of new facilities, are you now moving to anything that doesn't fit this, then automatically becomes
existing?
Existing?
Yeah.
Instead of having this
actually,
two definitions
that for today.
That would,
yes.
In the prior graph, I always thought left a gray area. So now you're looking with one definition. So if it's not, if it doesn't meet this, it's an existing.
Yeah. Okay. We didn't intend there to be a gray area in the first place, but I understand that language perhaps didn't clarify that well enough. So, yes, go ahead.
Just to be clear in my mind, especially.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. This is Lee Terry from California Department of Water Resources State Water Project. And I'm particularly looking at the new facility rating below 200 kV. Besides that generator interconnection upgrade item previously discussed here, are there other exceptions that you're thinking about associated with that in which they would not go to the, I'll say, the associated PTO and somehow on a, whether you want to call it a sub-regional regional basis or an expanded regional basis?
Where facilities below 200 might go into.
I'm just trying to see if there's other exceptions that you're talking about here.
And I don't think so. There's nothing I can think of that would be like that.
Okay.
I think anything below 200, certainly for internal to CAISO, we would not change how any of that works.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So. Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead, Lynette.
This is Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E again. I at the risk of parsing words, your statement, a new facility will be considered for regional cost allocation if it is rated greater than 200 kV. Does that mean it's not an absolute, that there could be greater than 200 kV that would not be included in a regional cost allocation?
Well, it could be that the benefits assessment shows that a certain subregion gets no benefits, right? So considering means we will assess the benefits. And if it turns out that a subregion gets no benefits, then they don't have cost, okay? Right.
We do have a caller in queue.
Okay, go ahead.
Operator, we can take the caller in queue.
This is Shalyan May from TransCanyon. So with regard to projects that would be considered for regional cost allocation, is it my understanding that if the project is primarily for reliability purposes and it is over 200 kV, that it would be considered for regional cost allocation? Is that correct?
Yeah, we would look at what benefits could result from the product, from the project to all of the subregions.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay.
And operator, we can go to the next caller, please. And caller, if you could state your name and the company you represent.
Hi, Jesse Cowell with ICNU. Lorenzo, I had just a question here on this page with the assumption for today's discussion that TRR is recovered via volumetric rate change charged. ICNU has commented, I think, a couple times about the need to have flexibility here based on how Pacific Core does things, and just wanted to get your thoughts on why that's the assumption for today.
Well, one of the reasons is that we're not trying to make today's discussion cover everything in the entire proposal, and we wanted to limit it to these two specific topics. The other is that we have some more understanding to do, I think, about how what the ISO may charge, how it applies its TAC and collects from, say, PacifiCorp in our wholesale settlement process may or may not constrain how those same costs could be passed on to customers within PacifiCorp's region. And so that to me seems like another topic, just, you know, just as we talked about not wanting to change the cost allocation to PTOs within the ISO subregion. I don't know that the fact the ISO is using a volumetric rate in wholesale settlement necessarily precludes a solution of the kind you're looking for at the end-use customer level. So for now, we're making that assumption. The questions that you're raising are something we'll definitely come back to, but it's not part of today's discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome.
Two more callers.
Oh, my gosh. They keep multiplying.
All right.
Answers are supposed to make people happy so they don't have any more questions. Wait a minute.
And before we go to the next caller, folks on the phone, if your comments or questions get covered, you can always exit the queue by hitting #2 a second time.
Oh.
And I'd like to ask also the other previous callers if they could hit #2 to take themselves out of the queue so I know when I get back in. So if we could go to the next caller, please.
Hi, this is Dilip Mahendra, PG&E. While the discussion today is focused on transmission developed through the TPP, what's the process for transmission that's coming through the generator interconnection-driven process? Is that going to be identical to what's in the current CIDAP?
We're really not talking about the interconnection process today. So I would just assume for purposes of today's discussion that we're not changing the interconnection process rules.
So something like if a gateway type project gets built because of generator interconnection, that type of generator interconnection driven upgrade would be dealt, that's not spelled out yet.
I guess so. I feel like there's not really anything helpful I can say about that right now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
an operator, next caller, guest 13. And guest 13, if you could announce your name and the company you represent.
Yeah, this is Charles Mee from the Office of Repair Advocates. Hey, Lorenzo, I just want to, didn't follow the whole thing, kind of busy. Just want to, first question is regarding the 200 kV. Is that kind of a, I remember before we talked about a 300 kV. So what is the story about the 300 kV to not be considered rather than using the 200 kV?
Oh, 300 will be considered as well, anything over 200. So that's
okay,
230, 345, 500, they're all being considered.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand that. I'm saying is, so you assume maybe because of the diversity of the future new PTOs joining the ISO, some of the interconnections, the interties between the PTOs are 200 level, right?
Well, we just don't want to assume that anything rated 230 would not have regional benefits. We want to at least include it in the assessment to see if
right.
there are regional benefits. That's
and
all.
And then you through the study, you can identify how you quantify the benefits.
Right, and we'll get into that.
Okay.
More specifically in the next few slides.
Another question, thank you very much. Another question is about the PacifiCorp, for example, if PacifiCorp is first one to join, so the east-west will be considered one region, right? One sub-region.
Yes, all of PacifiCorp would be one sub-region is the current proposal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right, operator, we can go to guest 17. And guest 17, if you'd let us know your company and your name.
Joseph Abuliman from the California Public Utilities Commission in San Francisco. You responded to an earlier question regarding reliability projects. I believe you indicated that if a sub-region we are developing a reliability project, that you will evaluate that reliability project for economy for benefits to other sub-regions. Is this also true for policy projects?
Yes.
Okay. So now I think there's a slight deviation from earlier proposal that you will now evaluate both reliability, economics, and policy projects for benefits to other subregions as well.
Yeah. So, good question. I mean, yes, but we have a whole presentation that's going to talk about that. So let's not answer all the questions while we're on slide one. And I think I'd like to move on. Give him a chance to ask a question. But really, we will get to that. So that's what today's discussion is about.
All right, then. Thank you.
Let's move on. So is that your comment?
This is Pushkar Wagler here from Plano RCI, and I was going to just comment on that issue. But just an observation here, and today, rest of the day, we'll be talking about the new, how do you share the cost of allocation associated with new facilities, anything about 200 kV. So presumably, if you can do that analysis for new facilities, you could do potentially for the existing facilities too. So observation, I understand.
If we
that
double the size
table.
of the planning department, we
yeah,
could
we
probably
could
do that. Yep. Okay. All right. Can we continue? Okay, so I'll go through these assumptions really quickly. We're still on the bottom of page four. I discussed the less than 200 one, and basically that's the way it is today. And also the one after that, recovered via volumetric rate, we're not talking about changing that in today's discussion. And finally, the ISO's current TPP is a reasonable model for the structure of the future expanded TPP. We redesigned our transmission planning process pretty thoroughly in 2010, and our belief is that it's a good process, and that it's logical, it's transparent, and it's got a lot of features about it that, even though people are often dissatisfied with outcomes, I shouldn't say often, sometimes, that it's a good model. We're not here yet to try to redesign something, but let's say that this is the process we're working with. It makes sense, and we don't see any reason at this point why it wouldn't work if we go to a larger region. So we'll use that as a model for explaining how we're going to think about the cost allocation. So the idea is, with the addition of a significant new PTO, the ISO would conduct an expanded TPP to determine needs and approve transmission upgrades and additions. Now, first line of that new PTO, let me point out that another assumption that we're making in today's discussion is if there's an embedded entity inside one of the existing subregions and becomes a new PTO by joining the ISO, we're assuming for today's discussion that that entity joins that subregion that it's embedded in. We had in our prior proposal put out the idea that maybe there should be a one-time choice. Does the new entity create its own subregion, or does it join the one it's embedded in? We got a lot of comments on that, and as we're thinking about it, I wouldn't call that an ISO proposal, but we're leaning in the direction of saying if you're inside an existing subregion and you use ISO as a PTO, then you're going to be part of that subregion for TAC cost allocation purposes. So I think, again, it's just an assumption for what we're making today. If there are parties who really like the other way, this is something we'll come back to in our next proposal, but we needed to assume something, which is important not only for the morning discussion, but for the afternoon discussion as well. So under the expanded TPP, the ISO would conduct the process of engineering studies, policy-based needs assessment with opportunities for in-depth stakeholder engagement, and Neil in a moment will go through actually in stepwise what those activities are. And then in accordance with default provisions, which is what we're here to talk about today, the plan would specify allocation of costs for the proposed transmission addition upgrades. Now, I'll just say one little thing about the Western States Committee or body of state regulators. Whatever role it ultimately has, if any, whatever decision-making authority it may or may not have, the point is that once ISO tariff has these FERC-approved provisions that are the default provisions, Any variation from that has to be approved by FERC. So a committee of any entities or a body of any entities, either FERC has to ex ante approve certain decision-making authorities that they would have, or if they come in with recommendations and say, we, all states, have agreed that we want to do this instead, that still needs to be filed for FERC approval. So at this point, the default provisions are important in the sense that that's the way it's done once FERC approves these provisions, unless FERC approves something else. So, okay, I see that got some hands up.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. I just wanted to clarify what you were just saying there. And first of all, I appreciate that you've listened to the comments and are working on a default. I'd like to think that, I don't know if this is correct, is the default really going to be how planning is done until the Western states change it or a committee or so? I mean, it's not really I agree it's the default, but it's also the first pitch, if you will, right? Not just the backstop. This would be how things would be presented.
That's right.
And then maybe perhaps the Western states could change this process, and then FERC would have to approve that. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I don't know, because there is no specificity yet to what this Western states group would do. Perhaps.
Well,
another possibility.
I'm suggesting you might want to make a proposal to them, and I'm suggesting that maybe we should all think of this as the proposal you would want to make to them, and then they might want to change it. Does that make sense, or am I missing something?
It's not within the scope of this initiative to make a proposal for what that Western States Committee ought to do. There's a whole governance discussion and activity in which that's being taken up. So all I want to do is set as a baseline, these rules in the ISO tariff, once approved by FERC, will specify how it's done. And if there is some other body that wants to change that, that has to go through a FERC approval process to change it, whatever it is they want to do. And that's really all I know right now.
Okay, so this would be the default process, and you would have a blank page as your transmission planning process going forward.
No, we do not have a blank page. We have what you will see today.
Okay.
Will be the process that we are proposing. Now, in terms of little tweaks to the transmission planning process itself, I'm just making the assumption that our existing model works in the future, okay? Maybe that gets some tweaks to it, I don't know. But in order to talk about cost allocation, we need to make some assumptions about a planning process and how it's going to work. I think what we have today is a reasonable model. How a future body of states may intervene and do something else, that's a big question mark, but I just want you all to realize that whatever they might do or want to do still has to get FERC approval once we have this process approved and in. Okay? Okay.
Operator, if we can go to guest 13.
This is Charles Mee from Office of Ratepayer Advocates. I have two questions. The first question is, and previously you talked about a new PTO, let's say, within CalISO, the current BAA, and so you consider that as part of the BAA. And I just kind of maybe, in California, not so many examples. Some of them, maybe for example, SMUD might not be qualified for that, LADWP might not be qualified for that, but maybe other small local areas might be. Do you have any ideas on that, or can you share with us on that?
Well, Charles, what we're talking about here, there's a whole list, if you look at the wheeling access charge that's posted on our website, there's a whole list of what we call non-PTO entities, I think is the
right,
title.
Right.
But it's all those
non-PTOs.
The important difference is that SMUD is its own balancing authority area. I'm not talking about other BAAs. I'm talking about entities that are inside the ISO BAA that are not themselves BAAs. They're just not PTOs.
Not part of the ISO control grid. Let's say that way, right?
They're not part of the control grid, but they are inside the control area or the balancing authority.
Right,
area.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And the second question is, I kind of curious on this, but maybe it's too early to ask a question, but the general idea is like on the second and third bullet, you talk about the cost allocation will be approved by FERC, but your expanded transmission plan will be approved by only by the board. I just want to get a clarification about what that board you're talking about. You're talking about the WSC or you talk about the ISO board itself? Or whether or not should
I'm talking about the new governing board that's proposed under the, or that will be developed under the governance activity, which
okay.
would be the comparable to today's ISO governing board, but whatever is the new version of that for an expanded BAA. So it's, we're not talking about the Western Committee anymore. We're talking about the actual expanded ISO governing board. And just today, our governing board approves our transmission planning process. So this is really saying it will be the same in the future, that the ISO as an operational entity is not making the final decisions. It all still goes to our board of governors to sign off on that plan.
Okay. So my concern on that is like, is that board is different from the Western State Committee, right?
Well, again, you're getting into an area where there's a whole lot of unknowns, and I don't want to speculate about it. Okay?
Okay.
The main point I want to make here is that we will have a well-defined process for how the ISO does transmission planning. It will have rules for the criteria for approving projects and for the allocation of costs over those projects. And at the end of each year's comprehensive plan, there will be a Board of Governors approval process for that plan as we have today. So that's all I'm setting as kind of a baseline for how to think about this process going forward. The other aspects you're getting into are really very speculative at this point.
Okay. So actually my real question is kind of, you know, the cost allocation.
That wasn't the real question that you asked?
I'm sorry. my ultimate question, let's say, is the cost allocation will be subject to FERC approval, but the transmission plan will not be, right?
That's right. FERC approves the process. It, look at Section 24 of our tariff. It really, what I'm assuming is that most of the process, as it's spelled out there, is what we'll be working on. So FERC approves the tariff provisions, and the tariff provisions then specify that the Board of Governors approves the comprehensive plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
David Oliver with Navigant. I appreciate the clarification on the embedded PTOs. I think it would be, though, I mean, you talked about the definition as it relates to CalISO, but as other balancing authorities join, like Pacific Corps, they have entities inside them. So I'm not sure if there's a strict definition out there or a more precise definition that may be useful for us to understand what you mean by embedded in this case would be useful. My question is, and maybe Neil can answer, is the expectation that the transmission planning process will still just take 15 months and still end in March of the following year?
Yes. For now, let's assume that. On the definition of embedded, you're right. We do need a more precise definition of that. We're not there yet, but I think conceptually it makes sense because these embedded entities are essentially taking balancing authority area services from the ISO by virtue of being embedded and not being their own BAAs. Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Both the callers.
Oh, we're done. Okay, well then, we get to Neil Miller's part. Thanks.
Are you really sure there aren't more questions for Lorenzo? Anyway.
Oh, we do have one.
Yes.
Hi, Shelly-Ann. If we can go to the line of Shelly-Ann May. And Shelly-Ann, if you could remind us who you're with.
Hi, this is Shelly-Ann May from TransCanyon. Going back to the issue of cost allocation and recognizing that the role of the Western States Committee in terms of determining cost allocation is still to be worked out. But is it envisioned that this Western States Committee would come up with a set of rules for cost allocations that would apply to all projects prospectively, or would they be coming up with cost allocation rules for each project that is approved through the TPP? I mean, do we have an expectation of how that would work?
We have no expectations at this point. We just have no idea.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, yes, I'm Neil Miller. I will be presenting the transmission plan discussion. It will be simplified because all of the questions have already been asked, so I appreciate that. No, but all joking aside, the goal here is to walk through the current transmission planning process as it exists today. Obviously, if there are adjustments that are necessary going forward, we'd look at those and have to have a reason to make those changes. At this point, we haven't identified the need to make any changes yet. So we're marching forward on the path, assuming that the process we have, as Lorenzo mentioned, is working, it's meeting our needs, but we're open to other ideas going forward as the need arises. So I'm going to walk through first our current process and how it's handled, and then I think Lorenzo and I will be tag teaming on some cost issues that would need to be addressed that don't currently need to be addressed as part of our transmission planning process to inform a cost allocation process. So the process itself, I think many of you have seen this slide numerous times. The ISO currently goes through a three-phase planning cycle. The first two phases are the ones that lead up to the actual development of a transmission plan for board approval that takes about 15 months. There's also a competitive solicitation process in phase three if projects are identified for approval that are eligible for competitive solicitation. Here I'd be focusing more on the first two phases. Phase one is the development in advance of the unified planning assumptions that would be used throughout that planning cycle. Phase two, which starts immediately after the board approves our previous transmission plan so that we're sure that our planning assumptions aren't being adjusted as we go through the board approval of the previous plan. Phase two is when we get into all of the detailed analysis, and we follow a very consistent and strict order in how we go about doing that analysis and identifying transmission needs. And I'm going to spend a bit more time on those stages. Now, the stages of analysis within phase two tend to lead to projects being identified at each stage. They do get modified along the way. So it's overly simplistic to think that reliability needs are only addressed by projects identified at the earliest reliability stage. Our analysis first is to look at all of our reliability needs on the system and identify what we believe to be the best solution to meet those reliability needs. The next stage is to review if there are additional policy-driven requirements necessary to meet state or federal or municipal goals. And at that stage, a previously identified reliability solution that we thought was the winner at that stage could either be replaced or augmented to provide the policy requirements as well. Now, we would then tag that project as a policy-driven project, even though it's also meeting a reliability need. The third stage is a broader analysis of potential developments for economic purposes, and that can also include revisiting a previously identified reliability or policy-driven project and saying, you know, maybe we need to beef that up a bit more. Maybe we had identified a 230 kV line, but a 500 kV facility would actually provide more economic benefits and warrants moving forward as an economic project that's also providing reliability or policy benefits. So it's really important to look at what other adjectives get added on behind when something is called a reliability, policy, or economically driven project. They're frequently including very important qualifiers and also providing other certain benefits. The other thing is that even at the reliability analysis stage, economics obviously come into effect in taking into account what is the best solution, what is the lowest cost solution. Now, the slide I've just moved to, which is in print that I can't read, slide 9, this largely reiterates what I just said. The one detail I want to put some particular focus on, though, is when we're doing the reliability analysis and looking at economics to consider what other benefits should be taken into account in picking the reliability solution, there we're doing a cost-effectiveness study as opposed to trying to crank out a benefit-to-cost ratio. We're saying we have these different technical solutions that would work. They have different capital costs. They have different transmission line loss profiles. They may also actually have different market impacts. So in landing on our reliability solution at that stage, we're looking at it from the customer perspective of what's the best reliability project. But we need to do something because we have a reliability need that needs to be addressed. So there isn't a requirement to get to a benefit-to-cost ratio of 1. I'll stop there and see if there are any questions that Lorenzo missed. No, just kidding.
This is Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. I'm just trying to understand. If we can go back to the prior slide on 8. So I think you had an example where you start with a policy-driven 220 project, and then you look at, say, the 500 has economic benefits. I see two sort of scenarios that can happen. One is when you go to 500, that entire project has economic benefits that are greater than 1. So my question is now that considered whole project considered an economic project or a combination of a policy economic project?
What we would say is our current terminology, which perhaps needs to be revisited, our current terminology would say it's now an economically driven project because that's the last stage at which the project got modified, and it's providing a policy need as well.
Okay.
But that's the qualifier. It would be an economic driven project with policy benefits.
Okay.
So then, and the reason we try to clarify that in the transmission plan is that if someone challenged the assumptions that we're leaving or the economics weren't panning out for some other change going forward, we do need to be clear that even if that economically driven upgrade was no longer viable, we would need to drop back and revisit what does it take to backfill the policy need that the project was also taking care of.
So in this scenario, I mean, the fact that it's economic, in terms of justification, you don't have to go back to the reliability because the entire project has economic benefits.
We would always capture that that's another benefit of the project because we wouldn't want people to be misled into thinking that if the economics, that there was some change that led to the economics no longer panning out, that we can just kill the whole project and we're done. It's, well, you have to consider if that leaves, we still need to go back and take care of the other policy or reliability need.
Okay, now my second one, which is probably going to be more troubling. The 220 was you did decide to do that for policy driven, and then you decided the incremental cost of taking up the 500 then is economic to do the incremental of the 500.
Yes.
Does that then get treated differently?
We would still call that an economically driven project that's providing a policy need. And I think the point I want to make here is that it's really important to avoid just looking at the one tag word and saying, you know, reliability projects meet reliability needs and nothing but, and policy projects meet policy needs and nothing but. The world isn't that simple, and the projects and the grid is not that simple.
I think it's probably clear where I'm going with this. In the former case I had, you could allocate this entirely based on economics would be one option of the benefits.
Well,
the second example I had where the first part was done on reliability, but the incremental had economics, where in a cost allocation environment certainly is a much more complex case because you assign only the incremental on economics, and you assign the first part on some other policy-driven basis.
Paul, let me just interrupt a minute. Great questions. I understand you have an early flight, but we're going to finish this topic this morning, and we're going to get to the stuff you're talking about.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to actually dig into that a little bit shortly. So if you don't mind, just
hold
that and we'll get into it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, I think there were other.
Hi, Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. In the process that's described here where you first identify reliability projects and then move on to identifying policy-driven projects, do you ever identify projects that are solely policy that don't also leverage, I'll say, the identification of a reliability?
Yes, we do. They may also provide some inherent reliability benefits on the grid, but they weren't meeting what would have otherwise been a criteria violation, where there's a mandatory reliability-driven need to do something. We do have policy-driven projects that aren't also avoiding a mandatory standards compliance problem. Yeah.
And then I will have another question about cost allocation when you have multiple facets of a project.
Yeah.
Thanks.
One second. I wasn't sure if you were done with the slide you mentioned about the I'm sorry, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. You mentioned that the it's a cost analysis that you do for the reliability projects and work on that. Is that the same case for the policy projects?
Yes, it is. And we do the analysis to the depth we think is necessary to properly test the alternatives.
Right. And then there's an evaluation whether more analysis should be done to do the economic part. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's actually two slides down.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I'll move on. Just this slide more talks about the different factors that are also coming into play that are making actually the transmission planning a bit more complex as we move forward. As we look at a broader range of issues that need to be addressed with higher renewables, generation penetration, looking at issues that historically had become pretty much standard operating practice and are now needing to be revisited. So I won't spend a lot of time going through this, but I wanted to just lay out that the transmission planning process is currently leading to fewer projects, but much more complex identification of needs as we look at renewable integration as opposed to the, I'll say, the good old just getting the power from the base generation to the load, which is what I grew up doing. Now, when we look at the economically driven analysis, as I mentioned earlier, it does build on the already identified reliability or policy-driven needs. It is another way to scan or another lens to look through for potential needs. We go through that through two ways. One is we have an open window for stakeholders to propose areas where they think there should be some additional consideration of potential economic benefits. We also do our own filtering by going through the system and looking for areas where we've identified congestion, generation congestion that could provide economic benefit to customers to relieve. That tends to normally focus on, under our tariff, we're not obliged to consider more than 5 study areas in any one cycle, just because this has to stay manageable. But that's another scan to look at the possibility of augmenting any other solution purely for economic reasons, or identifying a new project all on its own for economically driven reasons. But that's how we filter and look through to see what other projects should get more consideration than they already received when we picked what we thought to be the best policy or reliability solution. The stage for that is each year we go through developing our production simulation cases. We then move to doing our congestion analysis ourselves on the grid to see where we're seeing bottlenecks that could be impacting economic dispatch. We then do the evaluation of economic study requests, a preliminary scan to see if we think that some of the study suggestions have merit that deserve the deeper dive into their particular situation. We select the high priority studies that we will conduct, and then we do the detailed analysis for those areas through the relying on our transmission economic assessment methodology, which is really, it's the belt and suspenders scan to dive in and see if there are any other upgrades or projects in that area that should be made. Now, the team methodology, I'll spend a minute on that next. That does, it focuses particularly on how we will assess certain benefits, but it also opens the door to considering probably, I'm of the view it considers the widest possible range of economic benefits probably of the ISO-RTO tariffs that are out there. It really opens the door to just about any valid transmission system related benefit being considered, providing the credible case can be put together. But it does focus primarily on market efficiency and economic dispatch, as well as opening the door for transmission line loss consideration and capacity values of generation that might be now made available to the capacity markets. The current methodology and the current documentation provide a number of different alternatives or ways in which the economics of an upgrade could be considered. It's not just one standard approach that must be followed in all circumstances. It also creates certain sensitivities that could be considered to assess risk profiles and so forth. If the methodology, and this is foreshadowing what will be coming ahead, but right off the top, if we start looking at using the TEAM methodology as a way to allocate costs, it obviously would raise the question of, do we need to standardize on one baseline set of methodology and set of assumptions that are used for cost allocation purposes, with all the scenarios being developed to decide whether or not to go ahead or not. But that's something we can touch on later. The other thing I wanted to mention is that we have been developing updated documentation of the TEAM methodology. The current documentation laid out a lot of the original considerations starting back in the early days of the market operation. So there's a lot of detail and alternatives being discussed that over time, some of those have been winnowed out and we focus on some aspects, and others have been found to not be practical ways to move forward. So we do want to simplify the documentation, and that would be a separate initiative that you'll be seeing come out over the next few months as we try to update the documentation on current assumptions and current methodologies. Now.
Paul with Southern California Edison. Could you please go back to page 13? The, I think it's the third bullet in, does not currently include EIM benefits due to minimal exit provisions. Could you go a little deeper dive on what?
Yes, the question comes up quite frequently is, should we be considering or including in deciding if a transmission upgrade is economically justified, should we be considering the benefits that are generated through the operation of the energy imbalance market? To this point, we have not been counting on benefits that are dependent on the energy imbalance market because we're making investments in assets that have a 40 to 50 year life, but the energy imbalance market is easy to get into, but also comparatively easy to leave. So any one region right now would be very hesitant to unilaterally make a large capital investment that the benefits are dependent on their neighbor staying in the EIM when they can give notice and leave on relatively short notice compared to the life of the asset. Currently, the way we would expect to see that handled on an interregional basis is to get into the cost allocation discussion that if someone is also contributing to a project and we're both dependent on the energy imbalance market benefits and we're both making an investment, then that provides more assurance that the other party isn't going to leave and that you're still going to capture those benefits. But currently, we're not unilaterally looking at EIM benefits and justifying capital within our system on that basis. And that's the reason, is it's easy for someone to go home.
That makes sense. Of course, a PTO can leave the CAISO within a two-year notice, so if you're looking at 40-year investment and somebody can leave within 2 years. But they're definitely different. I think another point that layer in that, and I don't want to go too much deeper, is that the participation from the EIM entity by the people inside is strictly voluntary. The submission of bids can come and go at will. I think that's even a more stronger reason why you would probably want to do what you've done here.
So that's
thank you.
That's the current situation, and that gets questioned. But I wanted to clarify this is the way we're doing it today.
Pushkar Wagle from Clean RCI. I'm extremely glad that you're having this separate process to update the team methodologies. It's been a long time, and a number of things have changed, especially in regards to, we have made the case that, you know, production cost simulation model is pretty involved process, and then so that analysis is done very comprehensively, and there are a bunch of benefits which are done ex post, like capacity benefits, and also there is, you know, there are a number of things like the emission cost benefits which weren't addressed, but probably they should be. So I'm glad that you're undertaking those kind of efforts. What I would encourage is in that process, you would involve MSC at the front end market surveillance committee, and because they had pretty good, very good ideas about how capacity benefit issue can be revisited now in this new environment. And regarding the comments, because you are asking whether there should be a sort of standardized cost allocation process for using team methodology, those comments should we be providing in this initiative, or we should keep them aside for this new initiative that you're proposing?
Well, I think comments about a in this initiative, I think the question of do we have to identify a single prospective method, that needs to be raised in this framework.
Okay.
So I wouldn't dissuade anyone from submitting comments on that issue into this process.
Okay.
I think you have to get your comments known about, but for the purposes of cost allocation.
Okay.
When we put out our updated team methodology, if someone wants to provide comments about on that issue in the evaluation of whether or not a project is economic, that would be the time frame.
Neil, let me just ask you for clarification purposes. It seems to me, and I'll ask you if you agree, that issues related to team as it's currently used today to assess the total system costs and benefits, or benefits in particular of a project, belong in your initiative to upgrade the documentation and other methodological questions. Questions that have to do with cost allocation to subregions within an expanded region should be addressed here.
Correct.
Is
right.
Hopefully that's a sensible way of parsing out the issue.
Right, but I think you may have to revisit this, Pushkar here from RCI. You have to revisit the elements of team methodology when you talk about standardized assumptions.
Yeah.
We may have to put certain things here, whether, you know, these are the elements, whether they're palatable to other, like Pacific or the balancing authority areas, on how this kind of assumptions that we have, the unified planning assumptions, and, you know, developing portfolios for how that matches with
absolutely.
Yeah,
I think an important point, though, is that Neil's initiative is going to go forward even if we never expand the balancing authority area, and so it will be focusing on what is the role of team in our current way of doing planning for the KAIST. Anything
right.
that relates to what might be needed if we're now going to extend it to this additional use,
right.
that is sub-regional benefit shares that would affect cost allocation, then any of that is in this initiative.
Thank you.
Okay.
Operator, if we can go to line of Shelley Ann Mary.
Shelley Ann May, TransCanyon. So I just have a clarifying question. Is the CAISO proposing at this point in time that the updated team methodology would not only be used to assess the benefits of economic projects, but would also be used to assess the benefits of all project types? Is that, or am I getting that completely wrong?
That's the next part of the presentation. I'll get into it in a moment.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Eliane.
Yeah. Okay.
And I do want to clarify, it's Neil here, I do want to clarify, we were not proposing to a process to revisit the entire team methodology. We were looking at a process to update what we saw as the documentation, that the current approaches that we take in applying the team methodology would continue to be in effect, and it's a case of updating the documentation that dates back to, I believe, 2006. So the documentation itself is dated, and we do need to update the that itself. It isn't meant to update the entire process. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil. And let me say, for those of you who are sad that Neil has finished talking and is sitting down, he will be back. We have two more slides in this deck that he'll cover before lunch. So what I want to do now is actually talk about the concept that we want to put out today. This is really what we've been building up to. What I want to do, I think, is go through the next four slides and really cover that whole thing, because it makes sense as a whole package rather than entertaining questions on specific things, and then we'll come back to it. But I think laying out the whole thing first will be helpful. So I'm on slide 15. As a general principle, projects with no specific reliability or policy driver must have economic benefits exceeding the project cost, right? If they don't have a driver that's not captured as an economic benefit, then we're looking at what we call economic projects, and it has to have a benefit cost ratio of one or greater. The economic benefits of a project driven by a reliability need or a policy directive do not need to exceed the project cost. They could have a BCR less than one because there's another reason why the project needs to be built anyway, even if we can't quantify economic benefits. It's meeting a reliability requirement, or it's meeting a policy mandate. So with that as the postulate, that gets us to the next slide, 16, concepts for default cost allocation. If the benefit to cost ratio is one or greater, costs would be allocated to subregions in proportion to each subregion's benefits. And that sentence doesn't say anything about the project category, so presume that it would apply to all categories of projects. We do a cost-benefit ratio. We will do this assessment on anything that's over 200 kV, regardless of what category it's in. And if it turns out that we get this cost-benefit ratio, then that solves the problem, because everyone's getting economic benefit. Cost will at least will be no greater than their economic benefits. Let me finish the whole thing, okay, and then we'll come back and get the questions. If the benefit-to-cost ratio is less than one, then we have the problem that we can't recover all the costs by allocating costs that are commensurate with benefits. So we would say, well, each subregion gets a cost share equal to the amount of its benefits, but then there's leftover costs. So the remaining costs are allocated as follows, and this slide is just the first part of that. To the subregion whose reliability need or policy mandate was a driver of the project, if the driving need came from a single subregion. So that single subregion then gets the balance of the cost that's left over after you allocate cost shares that are commensurate with the. But slide 17, if we get into a situation, which I expect may not be that uncommon, where we've got a BCR less than one, but maybe the project is providing some economic benefits, but also maybe providing a reliability need to one area, maybe it helps meet a policy need for another area, whatever, but we're allowing for any of those possible combinations, then we need to give some shares of those additional leftover costs, that is beyond the economic benefits, to each of those regions that's getting that's satisfying a need. And so a question there is, and we've laid out just a couple of ideas, well, what shares, how big should those shares be that each of the affected subregions gets? One possibility, in proportion to its projected total internal load for the year in which the project will be placed in service. Another possibility, in proportion to each subregion's avoided cost if the subregion had to develop its own project to meet the need. So we may have, for example, in the planning process, come up with a most cost-effective but very narrowly configured reliability project that meets a reliability need in a subregion. Then we go through later stage of the planning process, we come up with a bigger project that now offsets that reliability need for one sub-area, but it also meets a policy need that's driven somewhere else. It just happens that due to the configuration of the project and the network and the regions, that those multiple benefits are there. So one way of thinking about what are the cost shares are to go back to, here's the sub-region that had the reliability reliability need. If we were to just meet that need with the minimal project, very narrowly defined, what would that cost be that is now, in a sense, an avoided cost by virtue of moving to the more expansive and more comprehensive project? That's another possible way of thinking what shares should go to each of the sub-regions when there is this multiple sub-region value that they get, which is other than the economic benefits. Last slide, and then I'll stop for discussion. Slide 18 picks up on this idea of avoided costs and poses the question of should these avoided costs be more explicitly put into the benefits calculation. So a sub-region's avoided cost for a reliability or a policy-driven alternative, what if we added that avoided cost into the total benefits calculation and then calculate the sub-regional benefit shares? So this little numerical example illustrates what I'm talking about. The preferred project, this is what's coming out at the end of the planning process, and we say this is really the best thing because it meets these multiple needs and has these benefits, costs $100 million. Now, when we look at what's coming out of TEAM, sub-region A gets a $30 million production cost savings, and sub-region B gets a $40 million production cost savings. So that's just looking at what the approach would give us. But in addition, because this project is meeting a reliability need that is just for sub-region A, there would have needed to be a reliability project narrowly designed to meet the reliability need that would have cost $60 million, but it wouldn't have provided any of these additional economic benefits. So when we start thinking about cost shares to these two sub-regions, the last two small sub-bullets, sub-region A is getting $100 million, that's the cost of the project, times this ratio, which is the total of its TEAM calculated benefit, $30 million, plus its avoided cost, and then the denominator of that ratio is essentially the TEAM generated benefits plus the avoided cost of that project. So the total benefits in the denominator is 100 and whatever, 30, right? 60, 40, 130 million. And so region A gets 90 over 130 as its share, and subregion B gets 40 over 130 as its share for 69 and 31 million respectively. So the idea here is that the notion of economic benefits really captures this avoided cost of what the subregion would have had to do if we didn't adopt this bigger project. And I end with the question, is the avoided cost of a hypothetical subregional alternative, is that an appropriate base cost allocation? So between this and the previous slide, these are really sort of starting places as ideas for how to do this. But at this point, let's start discussion, and I'll leave Tom to call on people.
Okay, we do have one caller that was in queue on the phone, and he's been in since Lorenzo first started, so I'd like to go directly to him first. If we go to the line of Sandeep Arora, please. And Sandeep, if you could remind us who you're with.
Yes, hi guys, this is Sandeep Arora with LS Power. Lorenzo and Neil, I think this is very encouraging. the entire approach in looking at a transmission project, especially a project which is a big regional project, and looking at it from, not just fitting one bucket, economic or policy or reliability, but really looking at the various benefits that a particular project brings. I think that's a really good way of looking at things. In reality, that's how these big projects are. They do offer multiple benefits. One clarifying question I did have, Lorenzo, for the slide that, I forget the slide number, but where you started discussion on the how these projects are going to be looked at. What if there was an economic project or an economic study request that was submitted and a project was just being evaluated, I guess being evaluated for just economics? The B2C ratio for the project turned out to be less than one, but if that project provides reliability benefits and also policy benefits, I presume ISO would still consider that as a project, not necessarily would be an economic project at that point because the B2C is not greater than one, but if it had other benefits, it would still be considered for, you know, more full-blown review and approval. I just wanted to clarify that.
I would say yes with qualification. And that is that in order to provide these additional reliability or policy benefits, it would have to somehow replace something that we were going to do anyway for reliability benefits. We're not going to look sort of abstractly and say, oh, this enhances reliability in the following way, but that isn't really driven by a reliability need. That's the purpose of the incremental construction of the planning process. We do the reliability assessment to deal with all of the requirements and all of the needs that are identified, and we identify mitigations for those. So in order to get a reliability benefit, somehow it would have to offset something we were going to do under the reliability construct. And Neil is nodding his head, so I think he agrees with me. Thank you. Does that make sense, Sandeep?
Yeah, no, understood. And absolutely, I was not talking about incremental reliability, but if it's offsetting an identified need, then that would be captured as part of the analysis. Similarly, I presume, if there was a policy need and this project was offsetting or helping meet that policy need, that would be considered as part of the analysis as well. And at that point, this project really does not remain an economic project. It just is more like a MVP project, like MISO or other ISOs like to call it.
What would we call it at that point, Neil? Because he was saying the benefit cost ratio is less than one and it offsets a...
Yeah, the way I would interpret that is that we have a reliability need or a policy need that could be met with one project, and then the economic benefit of moving to this other project is looking at the incremental cost and the incremental economic benefit. So in that case, the upgrade would be still rationalized as an economically driven project that's also providing this policy need, but it was the incremental portion that had a benefit to cost ratio greater than one.
Uh-huh, okay.
And that actually, I believe, was one of the questions we received earlier, mm-hmm. was getting around that sort of scenario in talking about my example of upgrading a 30 kV line to a 500 kV line. It's actually at the economic stage, it's actually the incremental cost that's getting the economic consideration. I think the cost allocation methodology that Lorenzo laid out still works. The economic benefits would be used to allocate the first tranche of costs, and then the reliability or policy need would be what allocates what's left.
Okay.
So it still works. But to be clear, an economically driven upgrade is looking at the where there already is a project in flight. You're looking at the incremental cost and incremental benefits.
Yeah.
Not necessarily saying the total cost.
Okay, so I think that's important, Sandeep, is that you started out with the hypothesis that the BCR for the project is less than one. But in the planning process, we would be looking for an incremental cost and the additional economic benefits to yield a BER that's greater than one.
Right.
Okay, thank you, guys.
But, sorry, I think there was a follow-up question about, maybe we should just clarify.
Ask your question into the mic.
The way you repeated what I think Neil said had me confused again, because I think, Neil, you said the BCR applies only to the economic portion of the upgrade, meaning that has to be greater than one.
That's right.
Right. And yes. not the entire part.
And I'm agreeing with that, but I was responding to Sandeep's initial hypothesis of a total BCR being less than one, which if you looked at the total cost, you wouldn't get a ratio greater than one. So, all right, Tom, keep going.
Hi, I'm Hank McIntosh from San Diego Gas and Electric. It seems to me that going not so much on the allocation stuff, but and what counts as total benefits calculation, you were saying that perhaps not only the team sort of congestion-driven improvements are beneficial, but also the avoided reinforcement costs of alternative reliability projects might be counted as benefits. I think that's right, but wouldn't you have to be pretty sure you weren't looking at sort of an unperformed reliability study? It would have to be not an engineering dream, but somebody's existing engineering study or at least some accomplished work that shows that that would be a way to, that the alternative would be a way to solve the same problem.
I think Neil is the right person to answer that.
Yes, actually, that question kind of tees up a concern we had in even articulating this as a possibility, was the methodology.
Is there a slide you're looking at
yes,
that I should put up?
Oh, yes. I'm looking at page 18 that lays out the what we call the possible variant.
Oh, page 18. Okay.
At the end, we asked the question about, is the avoided cost of a hypothetical subregional alternative an appropriate basis for cost allocation? The reason we were looking at that is for some of the very concerns you raised is how much rigor goes into developing a sub-regional standalone alternative when within this broader footprint planning is expected to be done on a regional basis. The methodology we laid out here largely, this more closely emulates the inter-regional cost allocation methodology. But the difference there is that our interregional neighbors are under no obligation to actually move forward with the project. So there we have to develop a regional project on the assumption that our interregional neighbor might not be wanting to play ball, and they're not really, it would be very difficult to force someone to play ball if they don't want to. There's a strong power of veto within each planning entity's area. So the question then is, we would now be developing a hypothetical sub-regional alternative purely for the purpose of cost allocation. And is that really a reasonable or appropriate thing to do? How far do you go down the costing, the siting, in developing a detailed cost estimate when it's only being used for cost allocation? There's no intention that you would actually build that alternative. And unlike the regional, interregional process where the region has to assume they're on their own unless the other party decides to jump in. So those are concerns we have as well.
David Oliver with Navient. This is more of a comment, but it's similar to, I guess, what you were talking about. I mean, I think this looks good in kind of the theory, conceptual kind of idea, but the real issues are going to come in the application of this, and how do the alternatives get defined, and how do they get analyzed? And you know, we're talking about potentially transferring money between subregions, and that is usually not something that is fun to do. It usually can be fairly contentious if there's a process whereby it relies on some hypothetical alternatives and some evaluations that are not typical. So I that was just a comment I wanted to make. I think this is, in theory, a very good idea, but until we see more detail in how it would be developed, I think the avoided cost scenario, as the last question says, can be an appropriate one, but I think it's very difficult maybe to imagine a process that isn't in practice, except, I don't know, I don't want to say acceptable, but easily done. Let's put it that way.
Well, let me just offer for purposes of your comments and this conversation, there's two questions embedded here, which this last exchange surfaces. And one is, suppose we do have a cost estimate of a reliability project that we know can be avoided, in which case the project is identified, we've done the studies, we've estimated the cost, and so that is kind of a concrete, it's not purely a hypothetical avoided cost, it's a lot more concrete because our planning process had identified it as the appropriate mitigation for the reliability need. However, there's maybe a second variation of that question, which is the more difficult one, where there wasn't a clearly identified alternative project, and now we have to try to invent one for the sake of capturing some reliability benefit. So I think, you know, I'd like to see thoughts on both of those questions, because where there's a really identified one, the question still remains, should we add that into the total benefits for purpose of cost allocations?
So I'll ask a couple of questions. Oh, Lynette Kozlowski with PG&E. So along the lines, I'm assuming in this hypothetical very much what you just said is that the reliability project that satisfies the subregion A's need mm-hmm. is pretty well known.
Mm-hmm.
I presume that but for the, I'll say, upgrade or expansion of the project to address a policy need, that $60 million cost would have been borne by subregion A. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, that's the scenario.
In your cost allocation proposal here, I'm wondering why the $60 million wasn't allocated to subregion A to begin with, mm-hmm. and then the residual benefits were allocated based on the mm-hmm. benefits to the projects, because when I do the math, it looks like subregion A is paying incrementally $9 million more to receive a $30 million benefit, which is about 30%, mm-hmm. whereas subregion B is paying $31 million to receive a $40 million benefit, which is 77%. And if you allocated the mm-hmm. $60 million first, then subregion A and B would share the incremental costs on a more equal basis.
Good observation. I think that's certainly an alternative approach we can entertain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. I'll just give some observations and then I have a question. I think that, you know, reliability is mainly a local thing, and that allocating reliability only projects between PacEast and CalISO is probably not that relevant. And then as new grades come on, you know, the closer they are, the more likely they'll probably be embedded. So I'm not sure this reliability piece is really a big driver. Most of the projects, most of the benefits identified within the CalISO benefit studies were associated with large transmission projects accessing Wyoming wind and New Mexico wind and really driving a fair amount of the benefits of the ISO study. I believe all those would be policy projects. I'm not sure if they would be something beyond policy projects, because the benefits are pretty large and would be considered policy. And then there might be some economics as well. There was some related production cost savings and stuff like that associated with accessing Wyoming wind and putting in this transmission. But from a process perspective, I see that, you know, you're going to build up these projects, again, reliability for a process, reliability and policy. And then it looks like you're going to take every one of the projects that come up through that process and then do an economic study of. And I would think that that would destroy the planning group, or, you know, create lots and lots and lots more planning than is our work that is being done now. And I would hope that the same process that you have now to not go forward with economic study would be done, so that you don't, you know, use up all your staff trying to look at, you know, projects that have less than a benefit cost ratio on the production cost part that's less than one. Because again, if you're going out and getting remote renewables, those are all zero cost marginal price assets, and it really doesn't drive a lot of this stuff. So hopefully you're not planning to do the economic part on everything. And then the other comment I'd make is, you know, doing this avoided cost thing is directionally just the wrong thing. You're just trying to price out things and do estimates just for a negotiating stance. I mean, you can do that much more effectively a lot of other ways. So I think this avoided cost thing is really, you know, geez, if we weren't doing it right this way, we would be doing it this wrong way, and that's the basis of a negotiation between subregions. That just seems a very indirect and planning resource intensive way to not get much done. So, but the question is really on the, is there a threshold of when you would do the economic study or not?
Like a cost threshold, perhaps, or?
Some reasonable test.
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to do it for every project that comes up? I mean, I don't know how many projects you have every year.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Neil's going to talk about that. You'll get Neil back again.
Pushkar Wagle from PNRCI. Lawrence, I have two questions. One is, you have said that PJM's DFACS methodology for cost allocation for reliability-driven transmission is off the table as far as this conversation is concerned. But presumably, you're assuming certain other methodology that would determine one subregion benefits and other subregion does not.
Yeah, and Neil's going to talk about some of that in the next couple of slides, yeah.
So I guess
there is a power flow component to the team structure, right? So, yeah.
Right, that would, and I always wondered about the order 1000 established six principles to apply the original cost allocation, and one of the principles is that the benefit to cost threshold may not exceed 1.25. How do you think, I always wonder how that reconciles with the ISO's approach of just having the benefit cost ratio to be one?
I think as I read that provision, Order 1000, it says we can't set a ratio of, say, 1.5 mm-hmm. as a threshold to build a project mm-hmm. because there we're excluding too many good projects.
Right.
So we can't have a threshold that's higher than 1.25. I imagine we would comply with that requirement of Order 1000. If we come up with, say, an economic project mm-hmm. and the cost benefit is 1.3 or 1.35, then I guess FERC's order says you can't say no to that project. At least that's my interpretation of it, and I'd wait for an attorney to correct me, but I don't see any. So.
But you think, that complies with the ISO's current methodology, team methodology says that if it's more than one, then that's good enough to approve it as an economic transmission.
The FERC rule just says you can't have a threshold higher
than
that.
More than 1.25.
Yeah, yeah. So
it doesn't necessarily say that it needs to be minimum 1.25.
No, that's right. You could have 1.1 or 1.05, and there still may be good reasons to go forward with it, and that does not conflict with the FERC principle.
Thank you.
Yeah. Eric, or was it? Or Paul? Or?
Eric Menzel, PG&E. If you could go to slide 17 real quick also.
Sure.
You proposed two methods, one and two, and then left the option open for a third one. Could you expand on your thinking both on methods one and methods two, advantages, disadvantages, to give us some insight into what the ISO is thinking, and then that would help us maybe work on something else if necessary?
Yeah, I would advise you to work on something else if necessary anyway, but because these are really, I think, just very kind of simplistic in a sense. But if you were to take, so we started with the presumption unlike what Lynette proposed, which was to, you know, do the other thing. But we started with the presumption that you could take a certain amount of the cost and allocate it in a way that is commensurate with economic benefits, and then we're dealing now with the leftover costs. And we're in a situation where more than sub-region has this non-economic benefit, whether it's reliability or policy or a mix and match. So the question is then, well, how do we allocate this leftover cost? And if you do it in proportion to the projected internal load for the year in which the project will be placed in service, then it's pretty much a load ratio share, which is a fairly conventional way allocating costs. And so we're just putting that out as, well, here's a conventional way people do things. Is that appropriate in this context? I don't think there's any deeper reasoning that we've put into it beyond that at this point. The other is to start to get to what comes up on the next slide is, actually, let's look at the avoided cost, because if we didn't build this expanded project that has economic benefits, we would still have to meet the reliability and or policy needs of these other areas, and that would have cost something. Now, that gets to the same question that we came up with, which is, well, do we know what that hypothetical alternative is? If we've done studies and we've identified a project, then it's really clear that this project would have to be built as the alternative. But if we haven't done that and all we know is it's meeting these needs, then I don't know, you know, that raises all the questions that others have brought up. But just as a concept, it seems reasonable to say that there are real drivers that are requiring that something be built to address them, reliability in one place, policy in another place, and meeting those requirements would have a cost. And let's let those costs figure into how we would allocate the share of that remaining incremental cost. The exact how to do that is the next step that we haven't gotten to. But there just seems a reasonable logic that says, look at what it would have cost those different areas to do something to meet their needs if they didn't have this project.
I think a more global approach to what Lynette was suggesting regarding the other slide is that, you know, if there's economic benefit to a project, then those costs should be separately allocated based on the economic benefit to each subregion. And if there's a reliability component to the project and it expands beyond one subregion or policy, then those costs might be allocated separately also based on how each region benefits. I mean, they're two separate components, and you can lump them all together into one cost allocation.
So just explain a little bit more what you mean.
Well, in your example, the $60 million went towards only one subregion, and Lynette was suggesting shouldn't that subregion then carry those costs, and they shouldn't be part of the total allocation. I'm saying you can take that one step further and say you have a reliability component, you have an economic component. Yes. You want to allocate them separately because different subregions, whether it's 100% or a portion, benefit differently from each of those components. And that's just an expansion on of what you're saying. It's not as simple as one's out and one's in.
So apply that same idea then, provided we have good estimates of what those avoided costs of hypothetical alternatives are.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, good point. And I think that's definitely something that seems to me we ought to be thinking about as we start to shape a real proposal out of this.
Hi, Alexandra Mackey, PG&E. Can you go back to slide 16, please?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the bullet 2 and the sub-bullet that states that costs are allocated to the subregion whose policy mandate was the driver of the project. And in an earlier iteration of the CAISO proposal, there was a principle that a state's policy, if a state's driving a policy, that state shouldn't bear the full cost of the policy-driven need. And so I'm wondering if CAISO is now moving away from that underlying principle, and is the implication here that only economic projects really have a region-wide benefit?
No, not at all. Thanks for pointing that out, because I hadn't put that thought in here. But this assumes that we have done team and identified economic benefits, right? And so I think it's consistent with the principle we articulated earlier that if something is identified as a policy project, we don't automatically allocate it 100%. We are doing the benefits assessment. We are going to allocate portions of cost that reflect benefits other areas get for it. No, this is the second bullet here is the benefit to cost ratio is less than one. Isn't that the one part you're talking about, the second major bullet? So the benefit cost ratio is less than one. Each subregion gets a cost share equal to the amount of its benefits, and then the remaining costs are allocated to the subregion that was the driver. So I think that's consistent with the point that the subregion of the driver doesn't get 100% of the costs unless there are no benefits to the others.
Pushkar Wagle here from Clean RCI. Just a follow-up question on the state driving the need for the policy-driven project. And that's pretty broad concept. Is you could have LSEs that are fully subscribed to their policy mandate for a long term, and they might not need to procure. So when you say the state driving...
I didn't say state. I said sub-regions.
Sub-regions driving, yeah. Sorry. So if the sub-regions are driving, then are you sort of envisioning some sort of portfolios that would have certain amount of resources that are dependent on certain transmission projects that are subject to regional cost allocation?
Yeah.
What's the notion there? Because it's a pretty broad concept
That's right. So one of the things we need to think about as we delve, not in this initiative, but in a later initiative, into the transmission planning process itself, is that right now in California, policy mandates are the state's environmental policies that are largely played out through the CPUC,
right.
And they give us the portfolios, the procurement portfolios, transmission planning, which is the link between the policy and the need for transmission. Presumably, if other states are going to have policies that create transmission needs, there will need to be some mechanism by which those policy mandates are translated into transmission needs. How exactly those play out remains to be figured out. But yes, there would need to be something comparable to what we're doing with the PUC today.
Thank you. All right. We don't have any other questions here. Well, actually, we do, but let's go to this one on the line, guest 13, which I believe is Charles Smee. He's been in queue for quite some time.
This is Charles Smee from Office of Repair Advocates. I think generally share Neil's concern on page 18. I think it is kind of maybe hard to identify the avoided cost. And looks like it is kind of challenging. And another question is, try to clarify is, looks like when you talk about the economic project really is based on incremental benefits and incremental cost of a project. Let's say a project 500 kV line, maybe originally based on reliability and the policy driven, it is a 230. And right now you build a 500, so that only the cost difference between the 500 and the 230 project should be considered, the economic components of that project. So the benefit cost ratio bigger than one, the requirement should be only talk about that part, right?
I think I understood that. Neil, did you want to say
something? Yeah, it's Neil here. I'd just say that in that case, I think the bullet on page 16, the second bullet, handles that situation. The benefit
right.
cost ratio of the total project is less than
mm-hmm.
one. There would have been upgrades that were economically driven. The economic
right.
benefits would be used to allocate out a portion of the costs that are economically based, and then there would still be some residual amount that needs to be recovered or allocated the other mechanism.
Right.
I think that bullet actually captures that circumstance.
Right. So basically, for this the second bullet on page 16, you talk about actually this analysis will apply to all the projects. For example, reliability policy-driven projects, right?
That's the proposal, to actually look at everything above 200 kV. Now, as Dave asked, at some point we may think there needs to be some sort of a threshold, but we haven't gotten there yet. But yes, all categories of projects certainly would be subject to this.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Charles.
Hi, this is Dave Smith again from Transwest. Just picking up on the point that Pushkar made in your response to that, with respect to policy somehow being dictated in the form of portfolios coming to the TPP process from outside the TPP process. I think that that's going to be a very sensitive issue, mm-hmm. because if other states have different views on who sets that policy, who determines how that gets determined, you know, you could end up with states with RPS requirements that don't set policy prescriptions the same way that the CPUC does on the basis of your MOU with the CPUC. And so if that comes up, I mean, everyone here could assume that it's going to be exactly like that. I could sit here and assume that it's going to be nothing like that and that there will be no policy requirements out of the Pacific Core subregion. And you have to think through what does that mean for this entire construct here. Because I can't guarantee, you know, how do you go about guaranteeing that the way that policy is done for the state of California is how that same prescription is going to be done here in all the other states.
That's a good point, Dave. We don't know how that's going to play out. I would say that in order to develop policy-driven projects, we need some way that actual policies get translated into needs for transmission in a way that's concrete and well-defined. We have that. We have a way to do that in California. How we will do that with other states remains to be seen.
Yeah, I apologize. I know where you are now in your transmission planning process. I don't know how you got there, actually. And I'm just pointing out that Pacific Core hasn't got to the same place that you have, and they would have to go through the same set of drivers to get to the same place again, I'm guessing. And so that's a big unknown issue to all this. I do have a proposal. I'll give it a quick tidbit now, but we can talk about it later. Is maybe you take the economic analysis from the people that set the policy and bring it back into the TPP, and then use that as some basis. Because then if someone didn't get it all for policy, they might have some economics that could be looked at. And I'm talking about economics associated with building transmission to access lower-cost renewables. But that's a broader – that's beyond what you have as an assumed, you know, continuation of your TPP now.
I mean, it seems like that would kind of amount to the same thing, right? Somehow it's still states – giving us a translation of their policy into needs for transmission.
Yeah, I'm just saying they might not give it to you that way. So you might have to take it from what the CPUC did with economics and bring it into your process.
I see. Okay.
Okay. Operator, if we can go to the line of Doug. And Doug, if you could remind us which company you're with.
Yeah, this is Doug Bocignone with Flynn Resource Consultants. You know, it strikes me that this linkage of the policy projects to the subregions seems like it's really linked to one local regulatory authority within the existing subregion. In other words, it's the CPUC's portfolios that are driving the current TPP. And if we're going to expand this to more subregions, should we really be linking it to the local regulatory authorities rather than to the subregions?
Well, that's a good point, Doug. I guess my response at this point would be to say probably yes, but it's not clear whether the ISO should be doing that or whether that's PacifiCorps' role. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just posing as a hypothetical that there are things that happen at the ISO level in our relationship with the sub-regional entities that that maybe could play out to that next level of granularity through the sub-regional PTO's policies, because it is a multi-state entity itself anyway and has relationships with its regulatory authorities in the various states. So I don't know.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking is, though, to the extent, I mean, I think I agree that probably makes some sense that they would need to manage that. But I'm also thinking that within the California subregion, maybe we should be doing something similar. In other words, you know, allocate, look to how each local regulatory authority is driving the need. Not just assume that all of the need is uniformly driven, especially in a subregion that's as big as the California subregion.
Okay, I see the point you're making. But, you know, you're now, I mean, that's kind of out of the scope of what we're talking about here is sort of California's existing transmission planning process. But I see your point.
David Oliver with Navigant. Just for clarification, so if Oregon, for example, had a very, like California, aggressive RPS goal, then that would be considered a policy initiative, if you will, for the entire Pacific Core subregion. Is that correct?
Well, it would be seen as a policy mandate that the ISO's transmission planning process needs to deal with.
Okay,
and
so
when we get to the cost allocation of the result, a share would go to the Pacific Core subregion.
Okay, so the entire Pacific Core subregion, as a subregion, could bear costs, or would bear costs based on the policy initiatives of one of the states within the subregion?
Well, that depends on what happens below the Pacific Core level.
So
the ISO settlement would allocate some costs to the Pacific Core region. What happens below that?
So Pacific Core would be able to settle as it pleases below that.
Well, I think that's I would put a question mark next to that because that relates a lot to the role of FERC versus the role of states in allocating transmission costs. So it's a complex question. But all I'm saying is, you know, how the ISO allocates does not necessarily mean that it's going to get spread all over all the states.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll offer, this is Lynette Kozlowski.
Okay.
So I have a question just about timing. And as loath as we are for revisiting cost allocation, there's all obviously evolving policies as already addressed, you know, states adopting new policies or changing their current policies. Are we intending for this process to be a one-time decision on how costs are allocated?
Are you talking about this initiative, or are you talking about the annual transmission planning process?
Maybe I'll refine my question. Are you presuming that the cost allocation of projects that might be driven by policy will be made as part of the transmission planning process?
The cost allocation to subregions, only to that level of granularity, yes. And that's what our default cost allocation rules would do as we're thinking about them today.
And it's a one-time decision based on the moment in which a project is approved?
It would be in the comprehensive transmission plan that the governing board of the expanded region approves. Yes.
So that's a yes answer?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Eric Menzel, PG&E also. Your earlier comment back with regards to Pacific Core having choices, how they allocate costs that come from the ISO's regional TAC process. Right now, within the California region, that allocation process is governed by the ISO tariff. And you see the sub-regional allocation as being opened up again as to how it functions? Because you sort of indicated Pacifica would have choices what to do with a single state's policy.
Well, In the tariff, I think tariff and the BPM spells out how costs are allocated to, well, the TAC is charged to distribution companies, right? And then it paid back to PTOs. So the PTO still has to recover 100% of its TRR. So in the case of PacifiCorp, it would be a sub-regional share of these project costs that go into PacifiCorp's TRR. Now, how that filters down to end-use customers is a retail rate-making question.
Well, that's true. So the TAC is charged to load-serving entities?
The way the TAC is charged today, it's to utility distribution companies, and it's based on the metered load that they report in their settlement quality meter data, or that scheduling coordinators for the load-serving entity. So, for example, in PG&E's territory, there are ESPs, there are community choice aggregators, and then there's the utilities bundled customers. Each of those load-serving entities reports, or their scheduling coordinators report settlement quality meter data for their load. What the ISO does is put all that together and charge PG&E, the distribution company, an amount of TAC based on that collective. And I'm looking at James to confirm, and he's nodding. So this is James from our settlements group, James Lynn. So.
And this may be, I don't know if there's someone here from PacifiCorp, but they may have more than one utility distribution company that they mm-hmm. would be the PTO for, and you're suggesting that they could have different cost allocation or rates among those distribution companies?
I'm just saying that I don't know.
Okay.
You know, that's the next level of granularity down. And so, I mean, that's an important question, but I don't know enough about the inner workings of what they do or what flexibility they have to change what they do. Because this still gets into FERC state jurisdictional questions that I don't know enough about.
Kurt Atten, PG&E, I have a more of a practical question. If multiple projects are going through a particular planning cycle and are having to look at the economics, and they may have production cost savings together and independently, do you look at them together? Do you do them sequentially? How do you determine who gets the best economic benefit?
Mr. Miller.
So it's Neil here. Our experience hasn't been to this point that they're that heavily intertwined. If they are, though, then we would have to sort out to either an order or put them both in at the same time. But we haven't landed on that level of detail yet.
So do you have just any thoughts on if you're doing an order, what might criteria you might use to select that order?
No, we haven't touched on that. But my first thought would be that we would be putting all of the projects in at the same time as a way to differentiate if they're intertwined. If they're clearly independent, then we wouldn't get into that. But that's the first thought. That's actually something, though, that we would need to have some serious input and discussion on. But getting into a who's on first discussion doesn't sound like a very productive conversation.
Operator, if we can go to the line of Charles Mee.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Charles, go ahead.
Hi, this is Charles from ORI. I think it looks like just now we talk about the cost allocation methodology compared, you know, being part of the TPP. It looks like, based on your previous slides, looks like that's not what I heard from you guys, because I remember the cost allocation, the default cost allocation has to be approved by FERC, so it is part of the ISO tariff. You know, it's separate from the TPP because the TPP plan, annual TPP plan, only, you know, required to be approved by the CalISO board. So it looks like the cost allocation, default cost allocation methodology should be as, you know, it is, looks like it is a standalone provision in the ISO tariff. And another way to say, another way to say is like the cost allocation methodology, it's not only good for 1 year.
No, the methodology would be in the tariff and approved by FERC. They would approve the methodology. The annual plan would simply do the calculations that the tariff requires and report the results.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's okay. Thank you. That's my understanding.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Well, then you're all really in luck. You get Neil back as a last treat before lunch.
Thanks, Lorenzo, and that didn't sound sarcastic at all. But
hey, Neil, did you want me to clarify a little bit? I just stepped it back into the room, and I understand there's some conversation going on with Pacific Corp, how we deal with our transmission. So obviously, it will be a FERC issue. Oh, Todd Deinhart, Pacific Corp, sorry. So it will be a FERC tariff that determines, obviously, what we have in our rate, all of that. Right now we have one company, Pacific Corp, but we do operate in six states. So six states have an agreement where we system allocate our transmission costs. From this, once you become a PTO here, that opens up a can of worms. You know, do we still allocate those six states? Do we charge different states different costs? That was something that will be decided by the states. That won't be a FERC decision there. FERC, though, does decide on a total Pacific Corp how we get charged our costs for transmission. So I think, you know, people were kind of mixing apples and oranges there with the transmission costs and expense. Hopefully that clarifies it.
Thank you. So this, actually, I'm going to spend very little time on this slide after this, but this slide that I've just turned to, the implications for the expanded TPP, I think really just articulate what people were already expecting from the earlier discussion, which is really that the additional requirements we would see is that for the projects that are crossing the sub-regional boundaries, that we would be required to do the economic benefits analysis for each of those projects and look at the sub-regional shares of the benefits, both for policy and reliability projects that we do not currently do. And we would also have to then go into the economic projects themselves and split out the benefits for those projects as well, as opposed to just looking at were the total benefits sufficient to warrant moving forward with the project. So as opposed to destroying the planning group, I would say this would be a growth opportunity for the planning group. And thanks for the feedback on that. I'm sure I'll be passing that along to our executive team if we move this direction. But no, all joking aside, it does mean going through additional steps that we do not currently take, which is, you know, testing where we have a reliability-driven project where we've picked the lowest cost solution. We do not go back and try to determine a benefit-to-cost ratio for that project. This would require more benefits, detailed benefits analysis for the subset of projects in order to do the cost allocation exercise. I'll just stop there, though, and see if there are any questions on that.
Pushkar Wagle from Finn RCI. So you're not really looking at the cost part there. You're just using team methodology at that point of time just to compare the benefit across multiple subregions.
Yes, we would have already been considering the cost effectiveness. Let's just pick a reliability project in particular. We would have been considering costs and other economic benefits in deciding which was the best reliability solution to go with. But that would have been a head-to-head comparison between different projects on which is the most cost-effective solution. Cost-effective solutions don't require, or analyses don't require actually landing on a benefit-to-cost ratio. It's taken as a given that you have to do something. Mm-hmm. And then it's, well, what is the most effective solution? This would require us to, it would be a consequence, is taking that additional step of doing the full benefits analysis simply for the purposes of cost allocation. Yeah, how many projects that involves, that's, we see that as an issue, but it can be managed if we go down that path. But that is a consequence of going down this path.
So basically, the ratepayer benefits, ratepayer impacts, would be calculated using the team methodology too.
The full benefits would have to be calculated, yes.
Okay, thank
and
you.
On a method that's agreed upon and used in both subregions.
Just David Oliver Navigant. Just wondering if, I mean, the economic example last time was very useful. I'm going to assume the economic examples coming up are going to be useful. Is there a way to get some economic examples of the various scenario situations here, policy, economic, reliability? Nothing, they don't have to be very complicated, but especially for those of us who are going to have to explain this to people above our normal pay grade. I think it might be useful in some regard to at least be able to see this a little bit more, less abstractly and more concretely. So.
I would certainly turn your point into a request that anyone who has particular scenarios in mind that you'd like to see examples and we can incorporate them into the next proposal that we put out, because you'll think of things that we haven't thought of. So if you have ideas of scenarios we should look at, construct little examples and put them in your comments. That'll be helpful.
Thank you. I think we may have taken most of the questions, all joking aside, most of the questions on this topic I think we backed into before we got to it, but I thought it was still worth touching on that point. Lorenzo? Oh, and I'm sorry. The last slide that we did touch on was just listing out, and this is more of the status quo of where the various benefits come from in the team calculation. So this isn't a new proposal. This is really more clarification of where the benefits are currently derived today. We thought it would be helpful just to lay this out. I don't know if it's necessary to walk through those. I think this is a more standard operating practice. Okay, I was saving more questions for time for Lorenzo, but no, just kidding. No, so sure, I will do it, sure. So production cost savings. So those do come through our annual assessment. We work off of the production simulation database maintained by WEC, build in our own modifications and upgrades each year, and that's our source for our production simulation benefits. Capacity benefits are manually derived. They're a bit more straightforward and don't require the same level of interaction with neighboring systems as production cost savings. So those benefits, to the extent they are included, are manual calculations on the side as opposed to coming out of a production cost testing. Transmission line losses, we tend to rely on the snapshot values coming out of the power flow cases that are used for the reliability or policy-driven analysis, and then we extrapolate them to produce annual benefits. We also use a social discount rate. As with our costs, the benefits appear over a period of time. We've also, rather than just rely on the upfront capital cost, we do project out the annual revenue requirement of a capital project and calculate the present value of that back using the same social discount rate as used for benefits, which we believe is a consistent ratepayer perspective methodology. We've had fielded a number of questions over the time about why we don't use the utilities returns as the discount rate, but We, putting it bluntly, we don't see that being directly relevant. But regardless of how the costs are being incurred, whether it's higher capital costs and lower operating or vice versa, what matters is the cost stream, and that's being compared against the benefit stream. And we do that comparison on a consistent basis using the social discount rate. Right now, I would say that our team methodology also provides a lot of flexibility in how we handle certain scenarios, and especially when we're looking at the risks. One of the reasons we've tended to avoid trying to be definitive about a specific benefit-to-cost ratio as being the threshold is that a lot of that depends on how you actually go about calculating the benefits and the costs, and especially how you factor in the risks. Any sort of risk premium. Once a project's been built, the costs are pretty certain, the benefits less so. So how the risks are taken into account in considering your costs and benefits, especially if all the benefits are front-end loaded or back-end loaded, we do apply some sensitivities there in our consideration. One of the methodologies built into the team methodology as it's currently documented is to consider the present value of the entire cost stream, but to truncate the benefits after 10 or 20 years and say, well, we'll assume that benefits out past that point are so speculative, we'll just truncate and only consider the benefits that appear within the first time frame. So there are options right now that are in the team methodology that allow for judgment to be applied. Those become a hot topic of discussion when obviously we're bringing projects before our board for consideration. But that flexibility is in there. One current question or concern we have is we would hate to see an artificially precise method get established in the team methodology purely for the purposes of cost allocation that actually detracted from the ability to bring forward good projects for approval in the first place. So there are pros and cons about making the method so precise for the purposes of comfort and cost allocation that it gets in the way of reasonable flexibility in considering the benefits of the project in the first place. And that really was the last point, was does shifting the team methodology purpose from determining a good project or not into cost allocation, does that also require that all of the parameters that are used in the cost in the team methodology be pre-litigated and specified in advance before being actually used in a planning process? So those were the last slides I had, just touching on some issues I think people need to be aware of as we move forward with these different concepts. And I would say none of them are, these aren't to us showstoppers, they're just issues that warrant consideration.
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. So the team methodology has been, is the first place, it's a in-use ratepayers perspective, and that does make sense when deciding to whether to go forward with the project or not, since in the CAISO's construct, pretty much load and exports pay for transmission. So that perspective makes sense. But as SC Edison had advocated in prior comments on in this initiative, and I believe in San Diego had also shared this, that for cost allocations, this benefits needs to both look at a consumer and producer's viewpoint of benefits to both. Is CAISO looking at this type of modifications or open to adjustments to the team methodology for the term for the purpose of cost allocation?
I have to confess I'm not familiar enough with that comment to really understand what that would mean in terms of the implications for the applying the methodology. So I think that's something if you could provide that
when
in.
When you build a transmission line from point A to B, consumers benefit because they have access to hopefully cheaper transmission, but the producers on the other side have benefited because now they have more customers to sell energy to. So there's two parties that have benefited. And if you're going to come to, you know, if they, the two had to meet to a degree of who's going to pay for the line, you would think that, well, producers would actually be willing to pay some money to be able to sell their product to another group of a larger pool of customers.
But if the costs are recovered from the consumers in that area, they would tend not to be that keen to support.
This happens all the time. How many tax breaks are given away to encourage development in the area? And ultimately, that's being paid by the customers in that area. It does seem, I agree, it seems odd, but this happens all the time.
And it seems, Paul, that what you're really opening up now is questions about just how we allocate the transmission revenue requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And as a volumetric charge to load and exports, following your line of reasoning, you're suggesting that really that's not the appropriate way to assign the cost, or maybe at least should be reconsidered. I think you make a good point, but we're sort of setting that off the table for the purpose of this initiative, primarily because we want to focus on how do the shares go out to subregions. And so whether that's a viable strategy or not, there may be differences of opinion, but I think at this point that's kind of what we need to focus on. It may be possible that at some point in the future there's a bigger question about the whole structure of the TAC and how it's recovered, but that's not part of that.
I understand for this workshop you're focused on these calculations.
Well, for this whole initiative, really.
But, you know, the prior initiative questions was, you know, one of the questions was, what changes to the team methodology, you know, do you think need to be considered? And many parties had drafted comments.
Well, I think it's also important to say, if we're going to put those benefits into the calculation of cost of benefits under team, does it make sense to do that if it's not aligned with how the costs are ultimately recovered through the structure of the TAC? Are those, does it make sense to have two different sort of logics for each of those?
Yes.
You think it does?
Yes.
So Ed, okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, I hadn't thought of that.
Because one is deciding whether you should build the project, and the other is who pays for it. So one is, one, the first question is, do you build the project? Yes,
right,
or no. The second is, okay, now how do we split up the costs?
Okay, so the decision whether to build the project under the approach you're suggesting, if I understand, would incorporate a calculation of the benefits that producers get.
No. Status quo, no change to the current structure.
Oh, no change.
Yes, because whether you're going to build the project or not, no change.
Okay.
It comes to the allocation is where I'm saying you need advocating a change, is where you need to look at consumers and producers. Because this is ultimately, you know, allocating between regions.
Okay, so if producers located in PacifiCorp's area get benefits, say they're selling to California, right?
Yep.
So that would show up as a larger benefit share for PacifiCorp's territory. But we're still allocating
cost to the customer.
Cost through to the customers through, okay.
But that region's benefited, you know, those additional sales have benefited that region through additional tax revenues, because I'm assuming, you know, those sales are going to be taxed, there's jobs, you know, all. If you read all these, like, stadiums get built, economic developments, they do things that ultimately get borne by the people who live in that region to attract businesses, and they're done because it increases tax revenue, it produces jobs. Mm-hmm. So this, I know it seems odd what I'm saying, but this happens all the time.
No, I'm not criticizing your suggestion. I'm just trying to understand
what you're
suggesting.
Yeah.
So. Do you think, and I don't want to spend a lot more time on this, but do you think it would be fairly straightforward to develop a methodology to actually do what you're saying?
Yes.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks.
Hey, McIntosh, San Diego. I agree with Edison's point there.
Both
of them. And it's pretty clear that logically there's a clear difference between assessing the benefits and costs, or the social welfare impact of a project is really a totally different exercise than forcing people to pay for it. Maybe in practical terms, lawyers really kind of link those two to make them practically the same, but conceptually they're surely different. And I think with a little work, maybe a conceptual model can be modified a bit to help out in the practical application for a cost allocation paradigm that could make this better. And I agree with you that it wouldn't be that tough.
Yes, it's Dave Smith with Transwest Express again. First of all, I want to thank you for having the session here. Also, I want to thank Neil for being here as well. I've kind of suggested a few times that having the planning group here as part of this TAC allocation thing would be really a helpful thing. So, and I learned quite a bit from the presentation. One thing I'd note is as you update the team methodology, you'll have to kind of write in how this for the economics associated with the policy, you know, shouldn't be considered in the team process. As I read the team process, that can be in there, and we've had this discussion for the past 5 years, Neil, and now I understand the difference between the tariff and what's in the dated team methodology. But given all that, one of my advocacies throughout this process, and I've stated it every time we've met, is the consistency between the process
without a regional expansion and the process with a regional expansion. So that's kind of a guide for me to say, you know, are these things sustainable? How is this going to work? And I'd ask you, Neil, you know, with respect to the ongoing TPP that you're suggesting not to change and the interregional transmission process, assuming that you had control of all the planners involved, okay, that's a big if, right? But that's what you're asking for with this. If you had control of all the planners, what would you see as materially different from this process that you're advocating here, these processes, from that without the regional expansion? And I'm talking about allocation of costs to, you know, non-CalISO entities.
So I don't think that this necessarily involves who's, quote, controlling the planners. I think at the end of the day, we've been of the view that our transmission planning process, we got there first compared to some jurisdictions because we had to deal with a broader range of circumstances. So we think we have a pretty good comprehensive planning process that allows us to deal with a pretty broad range of extreme requirements that can get placed on it. So we think the process itself is robust and is a reasonable platform in an expanded footprint. The biggest difference that I've seen, or we've touched on some of the differences between an expanded footprint versus continuing on our own regional basis dealing with interregional neighbors. We touched on a few of the differences today. One of them is we do have to consider a pure regional solution to any problem we identify because participation from our interregional neighbor on a broader solution that today we would call an interregional solution, but under this framework would become a regional solution across an expanded footprint. That's more optional today. The interregional nature is optional, so we do have to go further down developing our standalone regional solution because there isn't the expectation. There's the possibility, but not the expectation, that our interregional neighbor wants to play ball on a joint project. Also, there are issues like the energy imbalance market savings where I know existing participating transmission owners can leave. It doesn't have the same quick and easy provision that the energy imbalance market does. So the comfort of moving forward on a longer term solution is more straightforward. So certainly in an expanded footprint, there's more certainty that a good solution can be moved forward from a more centrally planned basis than having to coordinate through the interregional process. But in terms of the solutions themselves, we think there are ways to evaluate them in either case. Clearly, an expanded footprint makes it easier and more likely that a good solution that crosses that larger boundary will occur. The easiest way to manage a seams issue is generally not to have the seam in the first place. The interregional process manages a seam, so there are always challenges to that. But I don't think our process itself needs to be revised if we look at a broader regional approach. One of the concerns that we hear quite frequently is that our current once every year cycle is simply too quick for some of these much larger projects. We think we do need to maintain the annual process because it also addresses not just the big projects, but a lot of smaller needs every year as well. And it's heavily integrated into our annual generation interconnection process. So we see needing to move forward with that. But we also have to remind people, most large projects don't get identified, solutions baked, and approved all in a single cycle. Quite often for the much larger projects, needs emerge, they require further study, they carry forward into a few cycles, and it could be two or three annual transmission plans before we finally decide, yes, we're now ready to move and request approval of a particular project. So, like I said, those kinds of flexibilities make us feel pretty comfortable with the process itself, but the circumstances would have to be adjusted to fit the whoever joins.
Okay. Operator, we go to the line of Charles Mee with ORA.
Hey, this is Charles. This is Charles Mee from Office of Repair Advocates. I heard Paul Nelson from SC and San Diego talk about that concept. Actually, I myself have that same concept as well. So, you know, I want to see if it is like, for example, when you talk about cost allocation, maybe should we kind of make sure the cost allocation methodology is kind of in line with the decision to make a, you know, economic decision to prove a project. You know, if that's the case, for sure they'll be better.
We didn't catch that, Charles. Could you repeat that last statement?
I'm saying it's like, because my understanding is like the team methodology itself right now, you know, consider the benefits for producers and the consumers. But the cost allocation, the current mechanism is only the charge to load. So, you know, this is kind of a mismatch, let's say. So if it can be matched, they'll be great, you know, in my mind. Thank you for that.
All right, thank you. And it doesn't appear there's any other comments here in the room.
So lunch.
Yep, we are off to lunch, everyone. Our schedule shows that we're going to reconvene at 1:15, so we'll try to stick to that schedule. If everyone can be back in the room about 5 minutes beforehand, that would be great. Thank you. All right, very good. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you had a good lunch, and we've got a good quorum here in the room. And we also have our primary presenter, Lorenzo Christoph, who is back and ready to roll. So we will pick up where we left off, and at this point now, he's going to take us through the single region-wide export access charge. Lorenzo?
Yes, you are. Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming back. Never. No, he was excused for this afternoon. But I think we will have James Lynn coming back, who's our settlements guy, in case some of that were to come up, which indeed it might. All right, so we're moving now to a completely different topic. And to set the context, back in the last paper we put out in May that we discussed at the June meeting in Portland, June 1st, we had put in there the idea that for purposes of exports from the balancing authority area, we would like to have one rate that applied to the entire expanded BAA rather than different rates based on the sub-regional rates, one for Pacific Core and one for ISO. And logic for that is we don't want exporters somehow gaming the system to try and go after the lower cost export points and then start to create really bogus congestion because we have a rate design that treats the two areas differently. So having a single rate is not only based on that logic, but it's also been used by the other ISOs in New England, and PJM and MISO all do something like this, which is a weighted average kind of charge. Yeah.
Andrew Medet Smudge, just can you clarify if those other regions have the same rationale that you just gave for the different or for the same export charge versus like a sub-regional export charge?
The rationale of trying to have
a single rate.
Yeah.
And trying to avoid the gaming, I guess, is what I think you, the justification.
Yeah. Good question. I'll have to check into that and see what they might have filed in their FERC filings in adopting that. But I'll pose that question to our legal staff. Yeah.
Thank you.
Lorenzo, this is Paul from Edison. I think just for the sake for clear understanding, could you just go real quickly what you mean by export access charge and wheeling access charge?
I will.
To refresh everyone.
I will. Okay, so the first slide with a lot of words. So we made that proposal back in the last paper in May, but we really didn't go into any details. We didn't provide a formula for it. We didn't talk about how the revenues would get allocated out. And based on some subsequent comments back, we didn't properly distinguish between what we are proposing and today's wheeling access charge, which is also a charge that's applied to exports, but it's got some other subtleties to it that we need to tease out. So I'm going to try in this slide to explain those things. And in particular, I'm giving a new name to this new weighted average thing, calling it an export access charge, EAC, because I don't want to use the term WAC because it carries this other baggage with it. So I'll explain the difference. Today's wheeling access charge, or WAC, is charged not only to exports from the CAISO BAA, but it's also charged to a class of internal entities that are not PTOs, non-PTO entities. And if you look on our website, there's a whole page, a PDF file you can download that has wheeling access charges, and it lists out who these non-PTO entities are. They're basically embedded in the ISO control area, but by not having become PTOs, they're not officially part of the ISO control grid. So they come under what we call a WAC charge, but for purposes of this interregional cost allocation proposal and where we're going with this initiative, we really want to treat those two categories differently. In other words, we will have these internal non-PTO entities. They will continue to exist. And then we will have all of the exports from the combined area that go to neighboring balancing authority areas. And this proposal essentially says in the future they're not getting the same charge. Those two groups are going to get a different charge. So essentially, this proposal for this weighted average weighted average regional wide export rate is really to go just to exports. And under the second sub-bullet here, under the proposal, non-PTO entities would pay the same sub-regional TAC rate that's paid by other loads in the same sub-region. So if you're embedded in CAISO, then you're going to pay the CAISO sub-regional TAC rate, even though you're one of these entities. Whereas if you're exporting from the system, then you would pay exports, and wheel-through schedules would pay the EAC. Now, this is related, and I should mention this, to this notion of how we form new subregions, because if you go back to the May proposal, we had said that an embedded entity that decides to become a PTO would have a one-shot option to decide whether they wanted to be their own subregion or join the subregion in which they're embedded. We got a lot of comments back on that, and we even thought about them. So having thought about them, decided that, you know, maybe that's not such a cool idea, that because if you're embedded within a subregion, you're getting in many ways the same services that other entities, which are the PTO-based load in that subregion. It provides an advantage to this new joining entity that, in a sense, would not be balanced by a benefit to the other regions that it's joining. In any event, provisionally for today's discussion, I would describe this as how the ISO is leaning at this point in addressing these issues, because it's not officially a proposal. But for today's discussion, let's go on the model that if an embedded non-PTO entity decides to join the ISO and become a PTO, then it would join the existing subregion for purposes of TAC and TAC cost allocation. So based on that logic, then, it becomes a part of the existing subregion. It's counted as internal load to the subregion for purposes of allocating the subregional TAC rate. And now we're taking apart these two things that today are under WAC. And we're not proposing a region-wide weighted average rate for the internal non-PTOs, but only for exports for the combined region. Eric?
This has come up in the earlier part of this presentation this morning, but the criteria that is used to consider a new PTO to default into an existing subregion or be able to form its own subregion, the ISO could put some thought and effort to that and present it also. That'd be very, very helpful.
Yes, and we need to get to that. And I have not done it as of today, but we realize the need for that. I think if the entity is completely embedded, you know, geographically and electrically in a region, then it is getting the same balancing authority area for those services if it's not its own BAA.
Well,
but there may be some that are sort of on the periphery and integrated, and I don't.
Something else you might want to consider is how much of their load is supplied by resources internal to their area and how much is supplied by resources external, because that also indicates on how much they're using.
Well, that's how the access charge is charged to them.
I realize that, yes. And so I'm just saying in terms of whether they join a sub-region or able to form their own sub-region, you might also want to consider where their resources are coming from.
Yeah, maybe. I guess, well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because the way I was thinking about it is today if they have internal resources, the load that's served by those does not pay TAC or WAC. Right, so the fact that they have internal resources, in a sense, is compensated based on their billing determinant. And I'm wondering if that addresses the point that you're making.
I guess, I don't know to whom this might apply, what region, but an adjacent and or an internal entity that gets a large percentage of its resources externally, i.e. the adjacent subregion, might be more likely to join that subregion, that region, rather than become independent. I realize that they're paying for it today, whatever else, you know, but the question is how much are they relying on the adjacent subregion for their supply of energy? Because what happens is the intertie goes away, and that changes how things are billed, and in one instance they get their own legacy TAC rate, and another one they adopt the existing legacy TAC rate. And it, again, not just the criteria of are they totally surrounded or adjacent, but also maybe how much energy flows across an intertie, because again that affects the financials and affects not only them but also the adjacent subregion.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I see your point.
But so you might want to think about different criteria that qualify them for one or the other.
Okay, and it would be good if you include a little bit of that in the comments that you write up. Just make that point for us. Yeah.
Hi, Andrew again with SMUD. So in the last proposal, there was the embedded concept, and then there was the electrically integrated concept.
Yeah.
And so... And I heard the electrically integrated mentioned by PG&E, but I thought on the slide now, slide 23, you're just talking about that embedded concept, right? Because they're embedded in, like currently, an entity embedded in the ISO.
Yeah.
Versus, and the reason I'm asking is, you know, maybe, and it's not clear to me if the ISO considers SMUD electrically integrated, but I just want to make sure that we're clear that this slide's embedded. But I think what PG&E mentioned may be missing that it's not actually electrically integrated, just so we're on the same page, right?
Yes, but you're getting into an area of complication that I don't want to go to right now. I think, you know, we're not talking so much about an entity like SMUD, say, joining the combined BAA. I'm really talking about how do we treat these non-PTO entities that are inside our system right now for purposes of today's discussion? As we go forward and give greater refinement to this definition of what happens when an adjacent or closely integrated entity joins and it's already its own BAA, that's going to take a lot more discussion, and I can't provide you a complete answer to that
right
now.
You know, I'm fine focusing on the embedded. I just... I heard that term come up, and so I just wanted to make sure that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
That. So, yeah, we can just ignore
it
for today.
So for purposes of today, the important distinction is that these entities that pay the WAC that are not really exports from the ISO.
Correct.
Because they're inside the BAA, that's the distinction that I want to make, and that's really all that's material to today's discussion.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
We do have one call.
Okay.
And we can go to caller in queue, and I believe it's guest 53. And guest 53, if you could announce your name and the company you represent.
Yeah, this is Charles Mee from ORA. Gentleman asked the same question I think I have, so in general. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, that was easy. Thanks for answering Charles' question. Oh, okay. Maybe it's wishful thinking on my part. I think I covered this whole slide. You get the idea of how we're distinguishing between these non-PTOs versus real exports to neighboring BAAs. The EAC rate then is calculated as a load-weighted average of the sub-regional license plate rates. So we're assuming, again, something from the earlier proposal, that all the existing facilities are being recovered via license plate rates for each of the two subregions. And so those will then create rates that are subregional that we can then put together and create a load-weighted average.
Yeah. This is Eric Menzel, PG&E again. Could you expand a little bit on your choice of that methodology for the EAC, the logic behind it?
The first logic behind it seemed like, taking total cost and divided by the total load metric is a pretty conventional way to do a load-weighted average. The other multi-state or multi-region ISOs use essentially the same thing. So I think I would say largely it has the benefit of simplicity and precedent in other ISOs. If there's good reason to do something different, we're certainly open to suggestions.
So, and we can cover it later or now, but, when you do the math, and it was done actually also in your issue paper, the rates go from 11 to 8 and from 4 to 8 for PG&E and PacifiCorp, respectively, in terms of the EAC, which means that revenue collected along the PacifiCorp interties basically doubles, and revenue collected along the California interties, the remaining ones, gets cut by about a third. You have other choices, which has the potential, and you talk about it a little bit, that there's a revenue change or shortfall.
Or increase.
Or possibly increase,
yeah.
depending for whom and how you allocate it, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also have a choice of simply picking the largest TAC rate as your EAC. So I'm just mm-hmm. asking some questions here, and I wanted to know a little bit about your thinking. There are other options that are as simple or even
yeah.
simpler. Yeah.
Well, there are other options possibly. I think we picked this as a starting point, and based on some analysis, you'll see how it plays out. But the fact that we're collecting different amounts from each of the subregions, that doesn't determine the allocation of those revenues. That's a separate decision, right? Yeah.
Just for clarification, as you describe, Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E, as you describe the load-weighted average of sub-regional license plate rates, I presume that would also include any region-wide rates that are applied to each of the sub-regions. I'm assuming we're down the road.
Right, future projects. So,
yeah,
that's a good point. The underlying concept is that, following what we talked about this morning, if there's a region-wide cost allocation for projects, those get subsumed in the revised sub-regional license plate rates and get incorporated in. Yeah, sure. But that's an important clarification. Okay. So,
sorry, can
next.
I have one more?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
There are interties that are at low voltage. Will the cost or the access charge remain the same as it is today if it's a local or low voltage intertie point?
And I believe the way it is today, they pay both the low voltage rate and the high voltage rate, right? So I'm assuming provisionally for today, no change to that.
Okay.
Paul Edison. So they pay the EAC plus the PTO's respective low voltage rate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. For the things that we're not talking about here, as far as I can tell, and I've talked a little bit with James about this, we can pretty much assume that those things stay the same as they are today, unless we, as we go forward in this initiative, come up with reasons why they really need to change. You know. So, all right, so here is the beginning of the algebra I promised you this morning. Just to lay this out with a little bit more precision, I'm giving you a formula. So the structure is the TRRs are the two high voltage TRRs for the two subregions. L1 and L2, the internal load megawatt hours, typically they're forecasted values because you're setting an ex-ante rate that you're going to charge. I'm kind of abstracting from that distinction, but in practice that's what happens. Then the TAC rates for the subregions are simply the TRR for the subregion divided by the load, and that gives you the high voltage TAC rates. And the EAC rate then becomes the sum of the TRRs divided by the sum of the loads, and using E1 and E2 being the export megawatt hours for each of the subregions, then you get a revenue that's collected through this being the sum of those megawatt hours being the EAC rate. Now as we go through, times the EAC rate, as we go through the numerical example, just trying to really simplify it and just isolate what is the effect of changing the regime from the way the monies are collected today to the way we're suggesting they'd be collected in the future and see what those impacts are without changing any of the numbers, the export volumes or the TRR volumes or anything. Eric, go ahead.
On your loads, are you proposing using a forecasted load or a historic load?
In practice, we have to use a forecasted load to calculate the rates we're going to charge. And then there's an ex post adjustment that can happen through a balancing account or whatever. But we're initially having to calculate it based on a forecast because it's an ex ante rate, right? So, but, you know, I'm trying to abstract from that for the purpose of just focusing on the simplicity of the design and what it does. So, okay, next slide. So, the concept for the allocation of the revenues. So as Eric noted, the revenues collected from each of the subregions export points would be different than today. Those regions that had a higher subregional rate than the weighted average would be collecting, or rather we would collect, the ISO would collect, a lesser amount of revenues in regions that had a higher subregional rate compared to the weighted average for the same quantity of megawatt hours. And a region that had a lower subregional rate, we would collect greater revenues from them for the same number of megawatt hours. So what we're proposing, though, is to allocate the revenues back in proportion to the subregional TAC rates. So that if a party inside California, if internal load would have paid $10, then the California subregional share would be $10 times the megawatt hour volumes. And if load inside PacifiCorp's area would have paid $4 and something, these are the old numbers we're using, then the amount of revenue share allocated to PacifiCorp would be $4 times the megawatt hours. Now those are unadjusted numbers because if you just do that calculation, the actual unadjusted revenue shares don't add up to the amount of revenues collected. So we have to put in an adjustment that brings up the allocation of the revenues out to subregions in a way that they add up to the total revenues collected. Yeah.
Sorry, a comment and a clarification. On your first slide, you were listing the characteristics of the current TAC mm-hmm. methodology and WAC, sorry. And currently, when there's an export on an intertie, the wheeling access charge goes directly to the PTO that owns the intertie. And I think if there's a sharing, then it's proportional. But each intertie, that revenue flows back to the PTO.
Mm-hmm.
In your discussion right now of the current slide, you actually said something different that's presented. You said an entity within a subregion would get an allocation, and what you're presenting here is a subregional allocation without detailing, my understanding anyways of what you have here, how it gets allocated beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So did you misspeak, or actually are you actually saying there will be a TRR-based allocation to entities within a subregion?
What was the first statement that you're referring to?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to confuse my question. The first statement was simply that today wheeling access gets collected at an intertie, gets paid to the PTO that owns that intertie.
Through the ISO, though.
Through the
ISO, right?
Correct,
okay.
Yeah.
So the ISO is still collecting.
But it's a one-for-one. Yeah. And
right.
And what you're saying now is a little bit, what you said now is a little bit different than what's actually presented on the slide.
Mm-hmm.
You said that there's a payout to the participant within a subregion. Your slides just address an allocation to the subregion.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you've taken your proposal or are you adding features to it that I wasn't aware of anyways. Are you suggesting that you're going to allocate based on TRRs of each PTO within the region?
No. I'm suggesting that this allocation is based on the TRR for the subregion.
For the subregion,
as a whole.
Okay. And then
how that revenue goes down to PTOs, provisionally I'm thinking we follow the same procedures that we do today in terms of what individual PTOs get as shares of that wheeling revenue.
So you would do some volumetric allocation based on what flowed across different. You take a dollar amount divided by the total exports from that subregion and then allocate it by intertie?
Well, I haven't thought through the formulas. Perhaps James may want to comment on that. Thank you for coming in. We had a brief conversation about this, and basically what, you know, the concept is for stuff that happens below the level of the subregion, leave it as is as much as possible and don't mess with it. Unless there's a need to for some reason that we haven't foreseen yet, and that's quite possible. I mean, maybe there are lots of things we haven't thought about yet. But at least provisionally, how this plays out at the next level down from the subregion could follow what today's methods are for how PTOs get their shares.
Hi, this is James Lynn, Settlements for ISO. Now, we haven't gotten in too much discussion, but on a high level, in essence, what we were thinking of doing is once we get it into the point where you have like buckets of subregion, in this case would be, say, Pacific Corp bucket and then the ISO bucket, then you're going to use a similar methodology or the same methodology as you do today for the ISO subregion. So we would have to get it back down into TAC areas based on TRRs and so on. I haven't looked into how, basically we're going to take what we have right now and take the bucket for the subregion and allocate it the way we do right now. So we may calculate it up to, let's say, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting it. Let's say based on the megawatts going across the interties, we've calculated that $100,000 should go to PTOA. As long as all those amounts added up within that subregion don't exceed the subregion amount, that's what you will get assessed. I don't know if that helps or not.
So I mean, confusion to me is you mentioned TRR at the beginning, and now you're talking a little bit different. What happens today is if there's an export of 1 megawatt across a intertie, that PTO that owns an intertie gets the WACC rate, which is wheeling, which is TAC, as a revenue credit. So there's nothing about TRR involved or anything. It's simply just the megawatt gets that rate. So you're going to walk into this calculation, I presume, with a bucket of dollars because you've got that out of some sort of allocation between subregions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have, for that hour, some amount of exports across all of the subregions intertie. And if you're to take the exports megawatts, divide the dollars by the exports, you have a rate, and now you multiply each intertie by that rate, you get a dollar amount, and that's what you would return to the PTO. I hope that wasn't too fast. But you basically have a different wheeling rate for each hour based on the number of dollars you're trying to allocate.
Yeah. There's two ways you can do it, and that's one of the methodologies. That's why I haven't said and looked too much in detail on how we do it. You could create a sub-region rate and apply it to each megawatt that goes out, or you apply what your original in order to get the weighted rate, you have to have a start at what the original rate for that sub-region is going to be. You could apply that, and as long as that original rate doesn't exceed what you've allocated to the bucket. So there's two methodologies to do it, but what you described could be easily done. So what I'm saying is the way you described it is basically if we get a bucket and I calculate a secondary subregion rate, it may be $11 now versus $12, which was originally used to estimate the regional rate. So it just depends on, in essence, we would end up paying you $11 regardless of which methodology we used.
I think that works. I think that works. Okay.
David Oliver with Navigant. I'm having a little confusion here. You say in the first paragraph that there's this receive revenues based on the volume of exports. Well, basically you call it the unadjusted EAC revenues, but it doesn't. And then later you talk about the actual EAC revenues collected. And the first one I'm trying to understand doesn't really, they aren't EAC revenues, are they? The first one's not really EAC revenues.
They're actually subregion shares of the revenues.
They're subregion shares of the export TAC, if you will, or something like that, right?
Of the EAC.
The EAC charge has nothing to do with that first part, right?
The EAC charge only in that it, you're right.
Okay, I'll get it. And the second one where it says, does not add up to the actual EAC revenues collected, would it be more accurate to say to the actual EAC revenues as they should be collected, or the EAC revenue shares as they should be collected? Because it makes it sound like you're here it says the actual EAC revenues collected, but you haven't collected any EAC revenues.
We will have collected them by the time we're allocating them out.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It says here, it seems like it's saying here, it doesn't add up to the actual EAC revenues collected as if you've already collected them. I feel like it should be saying add up to the actual EAC revenues.
No, look, it's the end of the year. We've got a whole bunch of money that we collected last year, and we have to give out shares.
Right.
If we calculate those shares based on this unadjusted formula, those shares may not add up to the actual revenues collected. The actual revenues collected. And we're going to apportion them to subregions.
Okay, so, all right, I guess I'm just getting confused because of what you're talking about. There's this bucket of money that's from EAC. You're collecting.
The collections.
You're going to collect an EAC, and you're going to collect this E1 times TAC one?
No, that's how we're going to give it out.
Okay, so why does it say each subregion would receive revenues based on the volume of exports on that I guess I'm getting confused because you're talking about two different sets of revenues, and I'm not sure where they're going.
I'm talking about revenues collected from exports and revenue shares given to the subregions. E1 times TAC1 is a revenue share of what was collected.
Okay.
E2 times TAC2 is a revenue share of what was collected.
Okay.
So those are the shares that go to the subregions.
Okay. But you use collected again in the next paragraph, but that sounds like it's being distributed. Am I misinterpreting that?
In the next paragraph, may not add up to the actual EAC revenues collected from the exports. We collected EAC from exports.
Okay, I'll have to think about it. I'm probably the only one here who's getting confused.
It collected up.
What's that?
It collected up.
Okay, I mean, that's what's confusing me. You're talking about collecting revenues from different places, and I'm getting confused. So.
Cross it out
and
let's
go. Okay, thank you.
We're collecting from all the exports, every export transaction. That's the collections. Then we're giving out shares of that pot of money to the subregions.
Sorry, this is Alexandra Mackey from PG&E, just trying to help parse out the language. In the second full paragraph on slide 25, the word collected is just referring back to the collection process that happened in the first paragraph. So it's causing confusion, but if you take that word collected out, the meaning is still the same.
Okay. Hopefully, we'll go through the numbers and maybe they'll make it better. But in any event, as we allocate the subregion shares of what we collected from the export transactions, we want those two shares to add up to the total amount that was collected from the export transaction, and that's why the bottom two lines are these adjusted values that represent how we would actually apportion the total pot of money to subregions. And that is just taking EAC revenues and apply a scaling factor that retains the proportionality that was present in the top half of the slide. That's the idea.
This is Lynette. I don't know if this will be helpful or not, but your first bullet with the heading "this means" is a calculation of the revenues that would be collected by a particular, I'll say subregion,
yeah.
Not using blended
okay.
export rate. Is that
all
fair?
Right. Sure. Yeah, that's.
And that the lower part of the description and those formulas are a method to allocate revenues that are collected under a blended rate.
Yes. And to retain the proportionality that you had in the top two lines.
Correct.
Yeah.
But there's no assurance that the allocated amount under a blended rate is going to equal the revenues that might have been collected without a blended rate.
That's right. Probably they won't, and the example illustrates that they won't, which is why we go to those lines at the bottom, right, so that it all adds up. Okay. So, numerical example using 2015 data. So, granted, this is 2015 data, so it's out of date, things change, but I think the numbers at least illustrate the concepts of how it would work, which is the main idea here. And also because we could actually get the numbers from the settlements data, not only for the ISO when it comes down to megawatt hours, but also for PacifiCorp from information related to EIM, so that we could construct this. So. The idea here is to compare EAC revenue shares for each subregion after regional expansion to what the export WAC revenues would have been before regional expansion, keeping the same assumptions about megawatt quantities and TRRs and internal load quantities. Just look at that change in regime, if you like, and see what difference does it make to the money. And again, recognizing that these WAC revenues from non-PTOs are not affected by this. We're just pretending and anticipate going forward that they are just charged in some measure like internal load in terms of the rate that's charged to them. So for subregion one, putting in some numbers, these come from the TAC rates that are posted on our website as of October 19th, 2015. That's the TRR one is after the adjustments for balancing account and so on. That's the value that's left. L1 is the megawatt hours, and then you get a TAC rate of 978. TAC 2, these numbers for PacifiCorp come from a matrix spreadsheet that we put out last February with one of our earlier proposals. We gave parties a spreadsheet to play with that that had streams of revenue and load data for the ISO and TAC for parties to play with different ways of allocating costs. So I just took the numbers from there because we had numbers for 2015. But it's that spreadsheet model that's posted on our website is where this data comes from. And what you get for PacifiCorp is a TAC rate, sub-regional rate of $4.12. Okay, so now those values give us a weighted average according to our formula, $8.37. And now I'm introducing some new E values here because we need to distinguish in order to do this before and after comparison. There are interties between the ISO and PacifiCorp that cease to be export-import points once we create a combined BAA. So E1 represents some volume of exports that was, for which WAC was collected in 2015, but would no longer be collected in the future if the balancing areas are combined. Whereas E2 are exports on, when I say other CAISO ties, it's interties export points from our balancing authority area apart from the ones that connect to PacifiCorp. And E3 are similarly ones that are from PacifiCorp's area apart from ones that connect to the ISO. And then we've got a number here of W, which is the non-PTO load inside the ISO, which is 11 million something megawatt hours for 2015. So if you just apply what the ISO revenues would look like before expansion, before creating the expanded BAA, E1 times E2 times TAC 1 gives you $18 million plus a little. And the collections from internal non-PTO load is almost $110 million. And these are numbers actually from our settlements process for 2015. So these are pretty accurate. Yeah.
When you defined E1, sorry, Eric Menzel, PG&E, when you used E1, your definition of it, was it just the Malin 500 intertie point, or did you use other points, or what did you define as?
Yeah, I'll ask James to speak to that. I understand it's this one intertie called Crag. That was the intertie point.
All right. When, in order to pull the data or try to come up with the data within settlements, we don't have the ability to actually look at the tags itself. So I started looking at the resources which were going between ISO and PacifiCorp and aligning them with the resources called mirror resources. These are resources that were established to be going from PacifiCorp to the ISO from the day ahead market. And Malin, the EAM transfer that's used in the real-time market, that is not included in any of these transactions. That's the flow that's going through. It's not considered an export in any of these calculations. So for E1, this refers to the EAM, or the mirror resources between Pacific Corp and the ISO at Craig. I have exactly 1,136 megawatts that we're exporting out at Craig going into Pacific Corp over the 2015 period. So if there was additional exports at Malin, as well as any other intertide points, there's no clear way of identifying them. So you potentially could have some.
Sorry, Eric Menzel again. I mean, we get a monthly statement from the ISO for wheeling revenue, and it's by intertie and interconnection point, whether it's a DLAP or Malin 500 or New Malones or Tracy. They're all identified, and that's what our wheeling revenue validation is based on. So I'm surprised you're saying you don't have that data.
Well, no, the E2 does include the Malin 500, but the Malin 500 is a shared intertie between three balancing authority areas. I could not identify which of the data, the overall meter values was split between all three. You know, which one was going to Pacific Corp, which ones were going to BPAT, which ones were, you know, they were all going out of the ISO. So that was included in E2.
Okay, that's helpful. I thought that if Pacific Corp joins, the PACI 1, I think it is, or PG's rights, yeah, all becomes part of one control area, and thus the intertie goes away. And I'm under the impression that the revenue we're getting wheeling on the Malin 500, which shows up as a line item on our PTO bill, it's all based on PACI 1 exports. It shouldn't be based on anything else.
That is not my understanding. Right now, with the EIM, PACI is using its there's transmission in real time for the EIM transfer. That's not included in any of the E1, E2, or E3.
Okay, so I think we have the same understanding. EIM does not generate any wheeling revenue.
Correct.
But we show in our 2015 settlement data about 200,000 megawatt hours of volume on Malin 500. And it's pre-EIM, not EIM based.
I agree with that, and I cannot identify if the syncing BAA is Pacific Corp or BPAT, because that's a shared tie. That's shared between many.
Right. This is John with the ISO. So Malin would not go away as an intertie. It would remain, as it is today, an ISO scheduling point for transactions across Bonneville's system. Only Pacific Corp's rights on the north side of COI, which are the ones that are being used for EIM transfers today, would be turned over to ISO operational control. So what James is saying is correct both in EIM and in a combined expanded BAA. He's just saying he can't tell right now of the total volume of exports at Malin what share is sinking in the PAC BAA. And only that portion, only some sub-portion of that would actually be exports. There still would be exports at Malin to Bonneville, and there would still be an intertie, a CAISO intertie, a CAISO scheduling point at Malin, even after Pacific Corp joins.
Given that set of circumstances, is there a plan to determine how much will be in export so the revenues can be allocated? Because it sounds like this analysis just excludes it.
What do you mean by exclude? The Malin 500 exports are in E2. I have included them in the E2 because the assumption was that the rights that were going to be turned over are the exact same rights that are being used for the EIM transfer right now. So then the exports should not change once Pacific Corp becomes integrated. Only thing that should change that would be if the SCs change their overall practice.
So I'm going to try to clarify my question. Pacific Corp and PG&E will be participating transmission owners and will have rights at the COI. There will be exports to Bonneville at COI. Do you know how you are going to allocate revenues collected for exports between PacifiCorp and PG&E?
I have, let's see, I'm guessing, and this is a guess at this point, it becomes the ownership share.
So at COI, Pacific Corp has rights on PACI, right? They have an ownership interest on the PACI. And PG&E has an ownership share at that intertie as well, correct? So we haven't decided or come up with, but there's some has to be some sub-regional allocation of the export revenues at that intertie based on the ownership share of
currently today
the transmission.
Yeah, currently today we do have shared interties, shared ownership and interties. We use their ownership rights to determine what percentage of revenue across that intertie belongs to that PTO. So we would utilize the same methodology. If PG&E had 80% of the rights and PacifiCorp had 20% of the rights, then the dollars collected on Malin 500 would go 80-20.
I think one of the problems you might run into is that your EAC is going to be based on subregions. You're splitting a pot of dollars between two subregions, and PacifiCorp is in one and PG&E is in the other, whereas your methodology you have right now is within one subregion, so I'm not sure how that plays, but just be aware of that the intertie straddles two subregions.
Right. We'd have to somehow adjust how we come up with the doing a percentage there. You are correct.
Yeah. And then another question or comment. From what I understand, you put or left a very high volume of Malin, all of them, of Malin transactions in E2, in your E2 number. And you said that you can't distinguish between Pacific Corp exports or exports to the other control areas or entities. And in terms of doing a financial analysis as to the shifting of revenue and the changes, it seems important to identify the Pacific Corp exports. And if the ISO can't do it, maybe Pacific Corp could, and you could get those numbers from them. The Malin exports are a large number, and some portion of that would be anticipated to go away.
I understand. I'm guessing we'll reach out at some point.
I think it'd be great. Yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah, this is a first cut, so I think you're making good points. I think part of the question you're raising comes down to our definition of E2 and E3, which assumes that every tie is uniquely belonging to either PacifiCorp or CAISO, and you're bringing up a tie that is actually shared. So in some ways, these megawatts would be shared when we're counting up how much is on a PAC intertie versus a CAISO intertie.
Well, I don't understand how E3 was developed, because that's a PacifiCorp number. Your words sort of make it sound like it ignored interties between ISO and Pacific Corp, because you said other, but I don't know if that's fact or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could explain how you got at E3, that would be helpful also to understand the results of the financial analysis.
Well, James
back
can
to
explain
me.
That.
This is James Lynn from Settlements again. In the settlement system, each intertie that is scheduled in the market has a defined source and sink. And in the case of E3, the source of that would be Pacific Corp. So these would be all the external ties that go from Pacific Corp to other balancing authority areas. Almost all the ties that were considered between Pacific Corp and the ISO, Malin 500, Craig, and Mona, have a definition of being ISO interties. So the exports at those three locations are in E2. Anything for E3 were Pacific Corp interties going to external balancing authority areas with the exception of the ISO.
I think we have a couple of people on the phone have been waiting for a while. You want to just say something quickly, John, and then we'll go to the phone.
Clarify a little bit more about some of the uncertainty around the E3 number going forward. I don't know, James, do you want to do that, or do you want me to take a stab at that?
We can work on it together, but...
You mean after today, or you mean right now?
Just... So E3 raises a question because today Pacific Corp is two balancing authority areas. And the proposal for an expanded BAA would be that Pacific Corp would be combined into a single balancing authority area along with the ISO. So there's... Yeah, in a single sub-region. So there may be a lot of exports that are included in E3 that may not be exports in an expanded BAA. But we do not have those numbers, and we were going with 2015 data, and James looks like he wants to say something about that.
Well, a little bit. We have not been involved with how Pacific Corp has been scheduling using their rights with the external balancing authority areas. Depending upon the transmission rights that they turn over, we're expecting a portion of these export quantities to, in essence, go away because the transmission is now part of the overall balancing authority area. But without knowing exactly what schedules they're using with the other balancing authority areas that eventually will be turned over, we are not able to give you the exact number here. This is another number where we are going to have to work with Pacific Corp to narrow down.
And for purposes of this example, we just took a rough cut and said, what if 25% of E3 goes away? Well, goes away. It could be a big number, but so this again is more to illustrate a methodology than to provide you an analytical financial analysis. But
this is Paul Nelson from Edison. But what's really confusing on this is the non-contiguous nature of this new balancing authority would not go away. So that's why I'm puzzled about E3 is a transaction just even within PacWest could be an export, go through BPA, and come back into another part of
now, John,
PacWest.
John's got the answer to that.
So the logic here, I understand it's confusing. Today, Pacific Corp West in particular is non-contiguous BAA, uses Bonneville transmission, right?
Right.
So they have tags and exports and all that. The idea here would be that in an expanded BAA, the rights on the Bonneville transmission system would be under ISO operational control, and there would not be an import and an export. It would simply be a load being served by a resource. So,
okay.
Yeah.
But I guess in terms of the E3 numbers here, how was that handled?
So the E3 numbers do not take that into account.
Okay, so that would drop.
That's why I'm saying a large proportion of E3 goes away. We don't know what that proportion is, so we pick 50%.
So there's a big accounting change because today in this number you're counting those transfers going through rights on BPA systems and exports, but what your concept for tomorrow would be you would treat those differently.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Lynette Kozlowski at PG&E. Pacific Corp, I generally understand, has some legacy contracts as well as OAT contracts. I'm wondering how they might be reflected in that number and how they should be treated or will be treated in the future when under an expanded ISO.
So, I mean, okay.
We would expect that Pacific Corp would turn over all of their transmission entitlements, ownership interests, everything. In terms of encumbrances, I'm not sure encumbrances factor into this number here.
Are you talking about the dollars from existing contracts and how they affect your TRR? Is that the question?
No. Actually, I'm talking about the use of Pacific Corp's transmission system by entities that might be covered under legacy contracts,
so
therefore not reflected in numbers or should be reflected. I'm just trying to get a sense of what that number
is.
If they have a legacy contract, then the legacy contracts are being considered through a Pacific Corp stakeholder initiative with their transmission customers, but the current expectation is that those legacy contracts, pre-OAT contracts, so pre-Pacific Corp OAT contracts, would be treated the same as ETC's existing legacy contracts are treated in the ISO today. So the revenue that may otherwise be collected from those transmission facilities that may be encumbered, that analysis is completely separate and has nothing to do with this at all.
It
is not included.
They wouldn't be in these megawatt hour numbers, right?
I don't think it would.
They should be. Yeah.
So one other just comment for James. I'm sorry. On E1 up here, you've referred to Craig as the takeoff point. You might want to check and see if that is not the 115 kV interconnection between PG&E.
It's a low voltage, and so we can take it out of here. But the low voltage gets both charged, the high voltage rate and low voltage rate right now. So we kept it in at this time because it still would get that same rate plus whatever the low voltage rate would be.
Okay.
Do people ask? And can I just circle back? Sorry, Eric Mendel again, PG&E, and I know there's people on the phone, but I apologize. But we showed up in person, damn it.
In force, too.
In force, too, I know. Sorry. It would just be really great to get a better understanding of the Pacific Corp exports that are currently in E2 because those do go away. And I realize maybe that settlement information does not have all the data to do that. But I was under the impression that with e-tags, for example, you should have source and sink, and you should be able to figure out where the energy flows to in the end. But maybe I'm wrong again.
The e-tags will have it. The problem is going to be is the same discussion like before. Is right now Pacific Corp has turned or is using its rights for the EIM transfer. So if there is additional exports going out Malin 500 and sourcing into Pacific Corp, unless the additional rights gets turned over, they're still going to have to schedule that export and then import to use Bonneville's portion of the transmission. So without knowing if there's additional rights that are going to be turned over, I'm assuming that the Malin 500 will stay pretty much the same because we're using Pacific Corp rights now for EIM transfer. But again, I will work with Pacific Corp if we need to narrow this down.
Telephone.
All right. Operator, we are ready to take the two that are in queue on the phone. I believe the first was Charles Smee, and then the second is Guest 48. And I'll ask Charles.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Charles Smee from Office of Ratepayer Advocates. I learned that, especially when we talk about the E2, for example, you have a shared intertie. Let's just make the story a little bit simple even than the current situation. For example, at the COI, let's say assume at this moment, for a moment. Maybe not. But basically, you have three balance authorities, right? After, you know, right now you have the BPA, you have the Pacific Core and the CalISO, let's say. After the Pacific Core and the CalISO combine together into one BAA, you could have a situation, you know, for some hours or maybe in the same hour, both CalISO and CalISO generators and the PAC generators will export to BPA. However, because you have this different rate, you have a same rate or a different rate? It looks like you do have the same rate, right? For the EAC, it's the same rate at all whole ISO wide, right? Is that right?
It's a charge. It would be the same charge for all exports from the expanded BAA.
Oh, okay. If that's the case, maybe that's okay. I think basically I'm trying to say it's like if they are different, maybe the charge will be different, even if they are the same at the same, even they are export at the same scheduling point.
All right. Any further comment, Charles?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And operator, if you can connect us to guest 48, and guest 48, if you could announce who you are and who you are with.
Yeah, this is Joseph Abuliman from the California PUC in San Francisco. I just wanted to understand your example better. I wanted to know how you translated your TAC2 of 412 on slide number 26 and your E3 number on slide 27 into your revenue share on slide 29. I don't understand the relationship between the E3 for Pacific Core export, which is E3, and the Pacific Core TAC2 of 412 into the revenue share on slide 29. Could you please explain that to me a little bit?
Okay, we will get there. We're still on slide 27, but see if when I discuss that slide, hopefully I'll answer your question.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Okay. So, all right, we got this far with the before expansion of what revenues CAISO is collecting under these assumed numbers. Now, in order to think about what the after expansion case looks like, as we've been talking about, there's going to be a big reduction in those export numbers from PacifiCorp because of combining it into a single BAA and combining with the ISO such that transactions between PacEast and PacWest, where they now utilize rights that are part of ISO operational control for optimizing the BAA, those will no longer be exports. So that number, which is 34 million something, is going to go down probably by a substantial amount. We don't know yet what that amount is, so I just created scenarios that said, well, what if there's 25% fewer megawatt hours? What if there's 50% fewer megawatt hours? How does that affect the calculation of both the revenues that get collected and the shares of those revenues that go to the subregions? So that's the case, and then this table summarizes everything. So the top row represents just the PAC export megawatt hours with a 25% and 50% reduction. The second line is what are the EAC revenues that happen from those total megawatt hour numbers, and then using what I call unadjusted shares, simply taking the volume of exports. In this case, this is the number E2 for the ISO share, E2 times the TAC one value for the CAISO. And that number stays the same. It doesn't change across here. But the PAC share because now the E3 number is the one that's really being decreased. So when you multiply that by the TAC2 number for PacifiCorp, you get these different revenue numbers in the PAC adjusted share. What I'm calling leftover revenue, that just means that the actual collections in the second line exceeded the sum of these unadjusted shares. So there's additional revenue that results from that, and then I apply that adjustment that was described a couple of slides ago, and the adjustment is just a scaling factor so that the two shares add up to the amount of revenue that was collected. And those adjusted shares show that as you go across the scenarios, there's a pretty substantial reduction in PacifiCorp's adjusted share because it's the exports from their region that are going down. The adjusted share of the CAISO subregion goes down a little bit, but not a whole lot. And so again, this is just illustrating the methodology and recognizing that certain things in our assumption, especially those export numbers for E3, are really an unknown and kind of a guesswork at this point. But that's an idea of how it works. And I think that's probably the last slide. So, I mean, at this point, that's the end of the story that I have to tell today, but we can certainly continue our conversation.
Lynette from PG&E. So just to make sure I understand your calculations, on the ISO share unadjusted, you're saying those are the revenues that ISO members would collect today using the ISO only rate, correct?
Yes.
And that's all exports out of the ISO grid to other balancing authorities.
Not counting that 1136 that was going to PacifiCorp. It's if we had these same non-PacifiCorp import-export points, and we just use those. So this is the number that was called E2 on the previous slide.
Okay,
the other ISO type times the subregional rate.
And then similarly, the PAC share unadjusted is PacifiCorp only rates times whatever level of exports you assume.
Yeah, it's the number in the top row.
And then you are allocating the what we now call leftover revenue between the ISO and PAC using the unadjusted shares as the basis for allocation?
As the proportion.
Okay.
Right, they're the proportion. So preserving those proportions.
I need to think about this more, but it sure looks like a great deal for PAC because they're going, at least in, I'll use the scenario 3, which has the lower. They're going from an expected set of revenues of $72 million up to $129 million, while the ISO goes up from $18 million to $32
million. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to think of the equities on that one. Along the lines of the earlier example, maybe there's another way of doing it.
Well, some of it has to do with the actual volume that they have, because there's, even at the lower number, there's considerably greater volume going out of the PAC system than going out of the CAISO system. So there's the volume factor in there. Okay.
Operator, if we can go to the callers in queue.
Charles, your line has been unmuted.
Hey, this is Charles Mee from RRA. Maybe I kind of didn't finish my thought. Let me kind of think about that and share with you. You have this EAC rates is a different from the TAC rates, let's say, from the internal rates. I kind of have you consider like a, for example, a customer inside CalISO, for example, they pay the TAC rates, let's say it's $12 or something like that, but when you export, you pay a lower number. What is the, you know, have you ever considered the concerns on that? And for sure, you know, for Pacific Corp, you know, it's another story, right? For their TAC rate is only $4, but their EAC rate will be like $9 or something like that. So
yeah,
basically,
well, that's the property of taking a weighted average. I guess the question is how important is it to have a constant rate across all of the across the entire expanded BAA? And if so, what should that expanded rate be? Well, maybe there's something other than a weighted average we could use, as Eric suggested a while ago. You could pick the maximum and charge everybody the CAISO rate.
Because like in California right now, for example, you have the different schedule interties. Yeah, for sure, for the high voltage it's the same, but for the low voltage it's different. And after we expanded, so, you know, the area is so huge, do you really want to maintain the same rate, you know, for the whole big area? That's kind of the question. Just kind of throw this out to think about that.
That's the question.
Yeah.
All right, operator, we can go to the next caller. And guest 40, if you could identify yourself and the company you work for.
Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hi, this is Carrie Bentley representing the Western Power Trading Forum. So thanks for the presentation. It was helpful, but you know, it's really from the perspective of the PTO, and I understand that that's the main focus of this, but I think we would really appreciate this information from the perspective of the exporter as well. For example, when James was talking about how you might do that load leading average and how it might change by hour and how the export fee might change, you know, from a market perspective, that's a little worrisome. And I wasn't sure if that was actually the proposal or whether that was just, you know, discussing ideas. But I think that would be very helpful to provide. And I was wondering what the next steps were. Did you plan on providing that information? Or were you just going to go ahead and let the transitional committee work out those sorts of details?
I'm not sure what your question is. Would you clarify what the question is?
Sure. Like, how will you actually do the load weighting average of the EAC rate? Is it going to be hourly? Is it going to be peak load? Is the EAC rate for an exporter going to change?
No, we're imagining that it's a flat per megawatt hour rate as it is today. It's just a flat per megawatt hour rate, volumetric purely.
Okay, so
that's our starting assumption.
Yeah, that would be great. So showing what that may be, like today it's $11 right, or ish, or but you know, maybe doing that calculation for us, that would be very helpful. And then
I'm not sure what calculation you're suggesting, Carrie.
So what do you think the rate's going to be if PacifiCorp joins?
Oh, well, from the latest data we have, I think, in the example, it's $8.37. So we could look at projected TRRs and load numbers for any future year we like, but it's the same future. It's the, you know, so the ISO rate goes to something like $12. PacifiCorp's rate goes to, I don't know what, 7. It would be that load weighted average of that, but it would be for the period, for the year, there would be a fixed rate, which is just charged volumetrically. It's not time varying or anything like that. At least that's not not what we're thinking about at this point.
Okay. And so then in addition to the TAC, today in the CAISO, the exports are charged about $4 of uplift charges. Are you imagining those would stay the same as well, or are you guys going to look into looking at what's allocated to exports within this initiative?
We're not – this is really not dealing with market-related charges. This is really just the recovery of the transmission revenue requirements.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks, Lorenzo.
Okay.
And we have another caller in queue. Joseph, if you could identify your last name and the company you represent.
Joseph, your line is now unmuted.
Okay, this is Joseph Aboleman from the CPUC in San Francisco. On slide 28, you assumed that PAC exports may go down by 25% or 50% as a result of integrations. What are the driving factors for this export reduction? You may have explained it, but it's not clear to me what may drive this potential reduction in PAC exports.
Well, the primary driver is the combination of PAC East and PAC West and the current ISO into a single balancing authority area, where because PAC currently now is not geographically or electrically contiguous, a lot of what appear as export transactions are moving energy from one half of one of their BAAs east to the west or vice versa. In the combined balancing authority area, those would all be internal transactions. And as internal transactions, there would be no export charges associated with them. And they could comprise a significant proportion of what today show up as export transactions. So that's why we took a rough guess to say 25 or 50% reduction. We think it'll be pretty big, but I don't know really what the number is. This is just a good guess.
So these are not transactions between PAC and California. Are you talking of the relationship between PAC and California, or these are the relationship between PAC and other balancing authorities, right?
Yeah, that number would be between PAC and all of the neighboring BAAs, other than California, other than CAISO.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
any other questions in the
room?
We're
done. And Paul gets his wish. He gets to catch his plane. we'll send out something like a template for comments. But in particular, I want to tee up some of the questions that we talked about today. So because you asked a lot of really good questions, and we also are aware that this first cut analysis is really crude, and you want something that's more realistic, and we need to dig into some of the information sources in order to be able to do that. We haven't quite figured out yet how, but so we'll want some of your suggestions on what kinds of analyses would be helpful, but also different approaches that you see. So, for example, Lynette made the observation about how that leftover revenue gets allocated. And the share that PacifiCorp versus compared to ISO get. Well, we could go back to these unadjusted shares and stop there and do something completely different with the leftover revenue. Maybe we throw a big, or do something else. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be allocated through the method that I've got here. So this is really ideas, but if you got better ideas of how to do this, that would be fine. We do think that allocating shares that to try to align with the subregional rates to so that you can recover something that's comparable to what the subregions and their member PTOs are recovering today from exports, provided the total revenue collected from the EAC is sufficient. But if there's lots of excess revenue, well, maybe there's other ways that could be allocated that would be more appropriate. And so we welcome any ideas on that as well. So with that, next steps is fairly simple. The actual next steps will be out the door. But beyond that, stakeholder comments on August 25th, 2 weeks from today. And then we haven't quite figured out a timeline for when the next thing is going to happen. I would say we would be putting together another complete straw proposal, probably a second revised straw proposal at this point, to come out sometime in September. But we'll let you know more about the timing of that when we figure it out.
I'm sorry, did you have a date for when the template will be available?
Today is Thursday. Monday. I'll get it out Monday. Okay.
Any last questions? There's no one in the queue on the phones. If not, then we're going to make this a wrap.
Okay. Thank you all.
All right. Thanks, everybody. This concludes the meeting.